Hey, what's up? Episode 64 of the Jock and Nerd Podcast. Listener, this is going to be a special treat for you because on the show joining us is Sean Christensen. Sean and I went to art school together in Brooklyn. We were in a band together. He went on to form the awesome band Stella Star, went on to write some screenplays. He made a short film called Curfew that won the Academy Award in 2013. And the guy's just a super talented, all-around great guy. It was a great time with Rugboy and us catching up, hanging out. You're going to love this conversation. Check out the show notes, jockandnerd.com/64, because I want to turn all you people on to Sean's movies and music. They're great. Let's do this.
This is the Jock and Nerd Podcast with your hosts, Anthony and Imran.
Hi, oh, listener, welcome to the Jock and Nerd Podcast. My name is Imran.
My name's Anthony.
He's the jock.
He's the nerd.
And we are your co-host, but we're adding a third.
Of course.
Turns out Rugboy sobered up just long enough after our last interview show to join us again. Rugs, how you feeling? You hungover?
You wouldn't believe the headache that I have. I still have it. It's been like 5 days and I still have the headache.
Listener, go back and listen to whatever last interview show. It's the John Belotti one.
You will hear
Rugboy get sloppy drunk. It is fantastic.
But you know what I heard, though?
What'd you hear?
If you drink more, the hangover goes away. So I'm right back at it, folks.
Wowie zowie!
Yeah, Rugboy's trying to drink himself sober for this show. And listener, Anthony, I cannot be more geeked for who we have on the show today.
Yeah. This is another big one, right?
We have a talented individual. This guy has done so many things, I don't even know how to intro him. He's an illustrator, he's a musician, he's an actor, a screenwriter, a director. He was the front man for an awesome alt-rock band called Stella Star. And my man has won an Academy Award in 2013 for Best Live Action Short, little movie called Curfew. And he's a buddy we went to art school with, Sean Christensen. What's up? Thanks for coming on, buddy. Are you embarrassed? Did I embarrass you?
Yes.
Go ahead.
I'm embarrassed about all that stuff. It's all lies, really.
Yeah, it's on the internet, and you can't really believe it.
Wait, this isn't Richie?
No, this is Richie. Oh, look, it's Richie. Yeah. Sean, dude, thanks for coming on. How you been?
I've been okay. How you been?
Very good. You remember Rugs, right? You were back in the day.
I do.
Yeah, Sean knows Rugboy from back in the day.
I may know him a little bit intimately.
Oh, boy.
Oh, yeah.
He had his hand in my slack hole.
Oh, shit. There's a whole slack hole situation with Rugboy. We might have to start a Kickstarter to repair his slack hole.
Stitch that shit back together.
It's getting a little stretched.
Yeah. The only recorded thing on of us together in the same room was WPIR when we did, like, Pratt Radio.
Yep.
And you might have heard
WPIR.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what it was called.
That was the call.
I don't know if they still call it that. But that's when, you know, I met Sean Christensen, the man.
This is the guy you've been, like, telling me about for a while. I remember when we first started this podcast, maybe in, like, in April, you're like, we got to have this guy on. I'm going to have this guy on. I'm going to work
on it. Dude, Sean and Rugboy were two of my closest friends in college. Like, to have you guys together at once, it means so much to me. Like I said, listener, we went to Pratt Institute. And he was an illustration major with us. Again, another example, we've talked to a lot of people who go to school for one thing, and they make it big in something else.
Yeah. Yeah, but the illustration went nowhere.
No. And I learned that also after I graduated. I was like, oh, shit, that was a mistake. You can't. So, like, I got into graphic design because there's, like, health benefits and, you know, paycheck.
Did anyone besides Kadir Nelson stay in illustration?
He was good, though.
He was the man.
Does he end up doing something with it?
He did some children's books, I think. He did, right? He did
Drake's album cover.
Oh, he did Drake's album cover?
That's correct.
Shit. Which album?
Do you remember? The one where it's like the side of Drake's face and there's clouds.
Oh, yeah.
That guy was an amazing painter, dude.
Look up which one that is.
Okay, we're going to look it up real quick now.
If you own the fucking Drake album, you've seen that shit. It's everywhere. You want
who owns an album, though, nowadays?
What's the name of the album, though?
I don't know.
Who knows
about Drake? Do you listen to Drake, Sean?
I don't.
Oh, this one.
That one, yeah.
He just scored like 1,000 points.
We talked about Drake. Oh, this is definitely his style. Yeah, the guy was an amazing painter. Wow. Again, Sean is the fifth person from Pratt we've had on the show.
Is it the fifth?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It's five. I'm going to get, and that's just the beginning, dude. I'm going to get through all you fuckers and get them all
on
the show.
All your fucking buddies on this show.
Because everyone but me has done something with their lives, and I end up with this shitty show. So, you know.
Geek boner.
I got to ride on the coattails of somebody. You know.
I like it. So you're just mining the college. You're just mining the college folks at this stage.
For his own personal gain, yes.
Pretty much. But Anthony mines his buddies too, and he's got some
not
talented,
nearly as much.
Talented
not nearly as much. I don't
you don't exploit them as much as Imran does.
No.
I don't have any friends, so I'm not even of help.
Well, you know, we had to throw Rug Boy a bone. That's we're looking out for
him.
We're
feeding him with sandwiches. That's all that
we're looking out for you, Rugs. So we all went to Pratt, but we were huge movie nerds and like music nerds, and we all started kind of learning to play instruments at the same time, and we formed a band, and it was a lot of fun, and it was called Gister.
Gister Gestauchu.
There was Gister Gestauchu, which initially, it started as a parody band, kind of like Weird Al Yankovic, but then we started writing songs, and we got some gigs, and so you know, stuff happened. Remember in the last show I mentioned that my dad died of cancer in like 96? This was when I was going through college. So like at that point, for me, stuff kind of unraveled. I had to leave New York, right?
Okay.
But you guys, Sean and them get back together and they form Stella Star. And I fucking love Stella Star, dude.
Absolutely.
Yeah, we rearranged a couple members, I guess. And then Rug Boy. I don't know what happened with Rug Boy. Rug Boy was
how could you have a puppet as your lead singer?
Yeah, it's just logistically it wasn't gonna work because they didn't make mic stands that small.
Right.
We had trouble with the wiring.
No one could see him.
Yeah, it was like who's singing that? Like it just
right, like live band though with a guy that short just wasn't.
And my arms have no bones in them, so I can't play instruments.
You know, Ruggs did audition for the Muppets band at one point, but that chick with the dreads beat him out with the big DSL lips there. She beat him out there. So
you just threw DSL lips on.
Yeah, you know, like the old a slow modem speed back they used to have.
Oh yeah.
Sure. Well, whatever, dude. She's a cocksucker anyway.
Oh shit.
Oh.
There's bad blood between the Muppets and Rug Boy.
Is that right?
That's all I'm going to say. Like, look at that.
I would just point out that I'm surprised you knew what DSL was.
What, is that a new term? That's an old school term.
Is it?
See? All right, let's get back on top. Talk about the Muppets, bitch, all night.
I'm trying to get through Sean's journey because, again, like the Eric Sharkey, when we talked to Sharkey, how he had a great journey coming out of Pratt and making these awesome documentaries, Sean has had an amazing journey. So the point of all this is, I don't know what, is you guys.
I don't know what.
Buddy, who did you – you opened up for a lot of cool people, though, didn't you, at Stella Star?
Yeah, we opened for all the cool – we weren't the cool band, but we opened up for some of the cool bands. You know, we opened up for Jane's Addiction. We opened at one point. We opened up for here was the lineup. If you can believe this one, it was us and us being like a little new wave band no one really heard of. And then after us, there was James Brown.
Jesus.
And then and then it was the Red Hot Chili Peppers.
Oh my!
It's Stella Star. James Brown, he was alive, by the way, at the time the show took place. And then the Red Hot Chili Peppers.
Was it hologram James Brown?
Did you know about this?
It wasn't the hologram.
I knew about Jane's Addiction. I didn't know that lineup.
You guys played with Jane's Addiction. You guys had played with the Pixies.
They played the Pixies. Seattle,
right?
Yeah.
The Killers.
Yep. Yep.
And the list goes on. I mean, there's a shitload of bands that you guys played with on the same bill. That's fucking crazy.
Yeah, this was I don't know what they were doing inviting us on to these tours. They invited us. The Red Hot Chili Peppers one was, I remember, was to about 90,000 people.
Holy
wow!
Fuck. Where was that at?
It was in Hyde Park in London.
Oh shit! Open air.
Shit.
And you know, it was so many people that I remember thinking on stage that that there was so many people, it felt like I was singing to nobody, you
right?
Know, because the front barriers were like 50 feet away, and it was just a sea of. And I'm just sitting there just singing, not thinking if anyone can even see me and making weird faces, and I don't really give a shit. And then I have this wireless mic, so I go up to the front of the stage and I notice literally like 5 minutes before the end of our show, I notice that my fucking face is on a six-story high screen on both sides of the stage.
Wow.
So every stupid thing that I was doing for 40 minutes was everyone could see everything.
Oh, that's awesome.
Everything. That was an interesting one. But yeah, there was a few bands we toured with.
When you're opening up for a huge band like that, do you notice the crowd get into it, or is the crowd like, what is that feeling like with the crowd? Are they like waiting for the big band, or do you notice them really getting into
it? The energy has got to be amazing.
Like, what's the energy like?
Yeah, it changes like show to show. I think the bigger the crowd, the less you've got to get that energy. You know, if it's a small room, if it's 400 or 500 people, like not a small room, but you know,
a more intimate setting,
a little bit more of an intimate setting, you definitely get the energy, you know. And when you suck, you know you suck, you know, really, you really know it in those rooms. In the bigger rooms, you don't have a lot of idea of what's going on half the time. I mean, I'm talking about for a rock band. I think it's maybe different for different genres of music. Yeah,
is that the largest crowd you were ever in front of?
That was probably the largest. God, yeah,
that's an amazing experience. 90,000.
How are you gonna top that?
I can't. I've always wondered when you watch those videos, like, what does that feel like?
That is a good point. Whenever I've been to concerts that are huge stadiums, the energy isn't as cool as when it's a closed air, intimate setting.
Absolutely, you get charged up. That you're, first of all, you're in within like visual distance. You can actually see the expression of the face on the person who's singing. Mm-hmm. So that, like, you feel like you're in the same room with the person. If you're like fucking like a mile back, in, you know, you're not gonna feel the same connection, even if you're looking at the big screen. Like, every time I go to a stadium show, I feel disconnected.
Yeah,
I do.
Yeah, I remember like when we did gigs, and from my performing experience, you use that energy and it feeds to you and it feeds back and it cycles back around, and it's definitely there and it helps. And like you said, you know exactly if you're fucking bombing right away. That's some instant feedback.
Yeah. Yeah. Now the Killers, they opened for us.
Oh, wow.
Because Hammerstone? No, that was every
that
closet.
Was nowhere. That was. I mean, I don't even remember. But it was a. I mean, no one obviously knew who they were. If they knew who the Killers were, they wouldn't have been opening for us. But it was when they were starting out, and I remember at one point we were in. I think it was Wisconsin. Madison, Wisconsin, and there were 8 people who showed up for the Killers. And then 2 more for us. So it was a total of 10 people.
Wow. The Killers.
Wow. The Killers, fuck. Dude.
Hey, listen, you got to start somewhere.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
You guys, you also played with the Strokes too early on, didn't you?
Yeah. Our first show. Yeah.
Wow. Your very first show.
How did you get these gigs?
Well, the Strokes, that's a little different. The Strokes were – that was all part of the New York scene at the time. They were they weren't signed yet. They were really exciting. They always were a really exciting band, but at that time they hadn't figured out their first record yet, and so you just bounce into each other in the village, in the East Village, you know. You just sort of are playing with these guys, some of these bands together. So that was
question. All right, so you get this band together, right? You start playing shows in the village, right? I'm guessing. Okay, that's what you did, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, because that's what every band does.
That's what you do.
When does it happen? Like, when do you know that, okay, something shit's going to go down? Like, you're about to break.
People
are now interested in you in a different way. And how do you feel? What is that like, that moment, like, where you get discovered almost, or where you feel like you're onto something?
That's a great question. I guess we started getting a couple write-ups in the magazines and newspapers, the Village Voice or whatever. And then when you get the write-ups, some A&R reps start coming down, and then somebody we knew had a really good lawyer who he was a great guy. He was sort of handling a lot of bands that were up and coming at the time, and we just kind of got swept up into it and ended up signing with RCA. I really do think part of it was some of the little press that we were getting. We had a manager who was into publicity at the time, so he knew how to handle that for us, and we just we kind of went from there, I guess. Up until that point, it was maybe just a year of playing to nobody for a while, and then starting to get a little bit of buzz.
That's weird. Like, one day you're playing, you know, wherever, like a Mercury Lounge, and there's like, you know, maybe like 10 people that are there to see you, and then all of a sudden you're like signing a contract for a record label. You know, that's crazy just to think about that.
We duped them. We duped them.
No, listen, these guys are good. Check out, I know Stella Star has a rabid fan base. They were on RCA Records.
They're one of my favorite bands.
They're still some of my favorite songs ever. I will put links to stuff in the show notes. You guys, check it out, jockandnerd.com/whatever episode number this is. I don't know yet because we're
recording this way in advance.
Post for weeks.
When are we posting?
But I was recently watching, I found a playlist from your show in D.C. in 2010, 10th Row. It was from like 10throw.com. Mm-hmm. And it was like a nice multi-cam shoot. It was really well edited, HD video, great show. But so like they were good because there are hundreds of bands at the time. I know this from when we started to do this, toiling in New York City clubs for years.
I'm sure they get nothing. I mean, that's New York. That's a lot of major places too.
And for these guys to like put in a year and like, man, it was awesome to see you guys. And they were on Carson Daly. I would show up. They'd show up on TV and Sean would come through Chicago, play the Metro. And I would, every time I'd go hang out backstage, he would stay over. It was a fun one time. I remember the funniest thing is like you're booking whoever hadn't booked enough hotel rooms, and you're like, "Hey, can I stay with you?" They didn't book us enough rooms for the band. I was like, "Of course you can."
Oh yeah, no. I mean, it's not like we were touring in a you know, just to get away, just to get people's heads out of the space of we weren't in a tour bus for these tours. I mean, we were in a little van with a trailer,
with a trailer behind them,
just a little band trying to figure it out, and definitely did not know where we were sleeping from town to town. So your couch or your rug or wherever was as good as any. I mean, that was like probably what I was thinking about before I asked you. I was thinking, he's gonna say, he doesn't know it yet.
So,
I'm sleeping on his couch.
Yeah, it was awesome.
So, at this time in your life where you're starting to play these clubs and whatever, you thinking that I'm just going to do music for the rest of my life, or are you still thinking about film?
I was an aspiring actor, and I had failed at that miserably. So, the band was as good as any. And, I guess I thought I was going to do this for a little bit of time. I think I thought that was going to be. I don't know. I was going to be in illustration and it was painting, and then I was going to be into acting, and then I was going to be into music. And I was kind of at that point in time, I was sort of a jack of all trades, master of nothing, really. I just kind of was dabbling in these things. And I thought I was going to be in this band for a while.
What was your, you're the only guy that we've ever had or I've ever talked to that's toured with awesome bands like this. What was a favorite moment while you were doing this, or a favorite show, or anything that stood out?
There's definitely towns that were amazing. A funny story I remember was when we were touring with Jane's Addiction at one point, and I wasn't there for this, but I just thought it was hysterical. It was Perry Farrell was out around backstage, and the opening band was on, right? So there's an opening band, and then there was us, and then there was Jane's Addiction. And our drummer, Arthur
Kramer,
goes up to Perry and introduces himself and says he's a fan. And Perry says, "Hey, man, I love your band. Is this you guys playing now?" And Arthur was like,
"Oh shit!
No, we're not playing now. I'm standing in front of you here."
That's great.
That's a classic Perry Farrell, I think.
That's
where he is.
A lot of things go on the road.
So this drummer, Arthur Kramer, right? He went to school with us, and we mercilessly would make fun of him, first of all, because he was from Lithuania and he'd never seen Star Wars. And so we just gave him a lot of shit, just being assholes. And then we like tortured him. He wanted to be in the band for so long, and I wouldn't let him in because at that point he wasn't really that good. But he's dude with Stella Star.
I think he was the only Gister fan.
He was like a fan, and like he'd be like, "Come on, dude, let me play, dude." I'd be like, "No, get the fuck out of here." And he had to remind me of how much shit I gave him. I actually forgot how much of an asshole I was to him, and I apologized later. But when, dude, with Stella Star,
like a decade later,
to see him play, I was like, "Holy shit, dude, you're really good now." Like, Arthur is great.
Yeah, I remember I saw one of Sean's early shows. I went to someplace in Williamsburg, and I hadn't seen Sean in a long time. And I went to go see the show, and I had never heard their music before. I had never heard shit. So I went there, and I saw Arthur playing the drums. Like, I can understand that Sean being good at something. I've seen that before. But Arthur being good, because I remember at one point you guys were trying to record a demo, and I heard that Arthur's, like, the guys who were recording the demo were, like, mad at Arthur's drums. So the fact that I go to see this show, and this motherfucker's playing the drums like he's fucking John Bonham or whatever, Bonham or whatever.
He made a go of it, you know.
Yeah, he actually
you know, he really kind of made everybody, you know, he's the guy who made everybody rehearse.
Wow.
You know, there's always that one guy in the band who's like, come on, guys, on Tuesday, on Thursday.
You need the mom.
The rest of us were just wandering around being brooding artists, you know, in the village making $1 per year, you know. And he was like, come on, we got to rehearse on the Mondays or on the Wednesdays or whenever it was. He's the guy who made us, you know, twice, three times a week get together and, you know, come up with some music, some of it not working, some of it working. So he's the guy kind of glued all that together really at that time, because when you're, you know, whatever, 21 years old, out of your college, 22, 23, 24, you're just kind of, at that time we were just sort of doing a bunch of things and didn't much think that a band was a means to live off of, you know.
No, you just do it because it's fun.
Yeah, it's fun. That's why we did it. We always did it because it's fun. That's why we do this stupid show. Nobody's getting paid for this crap.
Absolutely not.
I'm not.
Next year, you guys turn your show into an app, and then you sell it for
$2. There we go. We turn it into like a satellite radio cable late night talk show. I don't know.
You have to be an app that everyone needs. They need
the
your
Rug
show.
Boy app.
Oh, Jesus.
How do we make a Rug Boy
app? The Rug Boy
app? Yeah, hang it all on me.
The Rug Boy. Yeah, why are we putting it on him? We're not relying on our talents anymore.
Yeah, I have no talent.
Yeah, we're like, relying on this guy.
That's what seems to sell these days in America. Have you noticed that, though?
What the
talentless fucks.
Yeah.
He's no better, worse than the Kardashians. Look at what they're doing.
Yeah, but they're hot.
Oh, shit. All right. The app will just do this.
Terrific.
Over and over again.
Does that bother you, the whole Kardashian fucking phenomenon? Does that bother you at all, Sean?
Does it bother me?
Yeah.
I don't think one way or another about it.
That's good. That's a good idea.
Let me analyze another point of this, okay? Okay, so Sean's in this band, all right? Yeah. It's fucking making great music. They're playing. They're doing these killer shows, all right? Around the same exact time that they're starting to get famous, this Napster shit fucking hits the fan.
Oh, yeah.
Like, everybody's going to LimeWire. Everybody's downloading music, and all that stuff happens. How do you feel about that? Do you feel like that, like the music, the value of music has changed?
Well, I loved that stuff. I loved people being able to get access to the music, because I wasn't, again, you know, my philosophy was that we weren't making, I mean, we signed a deal. We signed a record deal, which was really nice. And I guess I thought, foolishly, maybe, I thought that was the money. You know, I didn't think there was any other money going to happen. From there, I just felt like I just wanted people to know the band, so I didn't really much care. You know, the record label, obviously, the record labels got hit really hard around that time, 2006 or 2007 in that area. They got hit really hard, and they did this one thing to our second record where they put on the CD, they put
encryption?
Some sort of encryption where you couldn't burn it. More than three times, and you couldn't. This is crazy, but if you actually go, if you're the one person out there who's going to go out and buy the CD of Harmonies for the Haunted, I don't think you can put that CD directly into your iTunes. It's like blocked. You have to find.
Wow,
that's
like
a
proprietary DRM.
So it did affect you.
Yes. When Sony merged with RCA. It was all downhill for us.
That's when the shit really fell apart.
That was going to be my next question, is what happened?
RCA, the owners of RCA were not interested in music anymore. Ugh. And they sold the company, and so RCA went into Sony, and it was basically one of those cliche, you know, got eaten up by the machine stories. And I remember it was us, and I think My Morning Jacket, a couple bands, they test drove this whole philosophy of how not to allow people to put your CDs into iTunes.
Mm. Yeah, that's crazy. Two great bands.
That's
really
a bad idea. That was a bad
idea. Do you guys
idea.
Notice now, though, because of like Napster and how music is, no one buys physical music anymore. Yeah. Do you notice? I think it's forced artists to go on tour a lot more, because that's the way they're going to make their money. Have you noticed more live shows for your favorite artists? ever since all this stuff? Like more access?
Well, I mean, fans were always, you know,
going on tour.
Going on tour. I remember you know, Metallica really built themselves up by touring all over the place all the time. I guess I honestly don't know these days how they do it, because there's a deal called the 360 deal now, which is different than when we signed. It's a different kind of deal. When we signed a record deal, it was just for the records and the CDs. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, when you sign a record deal, you're giving away a percentage of the merch sales. You're giving away a percentage of...
They control the tour and they everything control stuff.
Because that's the only way for these record studios to make money, right?
Money. Yeah.
So to your point, music, no, when we toured, we got 100% of money.
Wow.
And nowadays, I think when you sign these contracts with those labels, you got to split your tour money. You got to split your merch money. Shit. We didn't have to split that money.
Back in the day, what were you making more money on? What was the split between like physical music and touring?
Oh, we were definitely making more money on touring. Not a lot more, but we were making more money on touring because the CD sales, you know, we weren't recouping on the amount that we, you know, you got to sell like 400,000 or 500,000 records to start making your money back from your pay advance.
Damn.
You know, so our pay advance for whatever it was, 6 or 7 record deal, I forget what it was for, but that pay advance was substantial. So we never made, you know, any money back on the CDs. It was all the touring. Mm.
So at what point in time do you like go, okay, I'm in this awesome band and I make awesome music, and then, you know, is it the record label or is it the business? When do you guys decide to like stop making music and do other things?
Well, we never broke up. We actually never broke up.
Oh,
we,
officially.
Well, I didn't think we broke up. I just decided to stop recording.
Yeah.
Well, actually, what happened was we just didn't call each other to rehearse anymore.
Well, it was Arthur. Arthur,
what
really
the hell?
Upset.
He must have...
He dropped the ball, a typical Kramer fashion.
Arthur lost his smile.
We all kind of lost our smile. You know,
The industry is rough, man, isn't it, for trying to make it.
And we were touring, and we just no one bothered to, after this particular tour in 2010, we got off the tour and we were exhausted, and then we just, no one ever called each other.
Man, it's rehearse anymore.
But you see Michael Jurin, you see Mandy, mm-hmm. you see them from time to time.
Well, Michael's in a project. Now Arthur has some stuff. I listened to some of his Dear Comrade stuff. It's really good.
They all have other bands.
So is there ever like a talk of like, hey, we're going to record something else soon?
Once in a while, there's a discussion, you know, that goes nowhere, or there's a discussion that, you know, usually the people who see each other the most is Michael and I. We see each other all the time because we live in New York, so we jam sometimes.
So Mandy was the bass player.
Name the names of the people.
Mandy's the bass player, unbelievable sense of time, like just a natural. Like you never had to tell her anything. No. She would just fucking nail it, and the best sense of time. Arthur Kramer was the drummer.
Right.
Michael Jurin on guitars.
There you go.
Sean Christensen, lead vocal and guitars.
Yeah, and Mandy really is the only one in
she
the band
still?
With rhythm, you know.
We really relied on her to like keep everything.
Oh, you played with
Mandy. Yeah, well, that was it was them.
She was on Gister.
Yeah, he just pretty much replaced me with Michael.
Got it.
That's how it went down. But listen, I was at the end of my thread
rope.
In New York at Rope. Literally, like I wasn't graduating school. I didn't have a job. Looking back, I said I was depressed. I was fucking in the bar. It all just kind of petered out. And looking back now, I realized like I was just really depressed and I didn't really know it at the time. But shit happens. Here's how we segue though.
Yeah,
I remember hanging out with you backstage at the Metro and you were like, hey, I'm writing this script. I have this idea for a movie. And pretty much it was a great concept. It was like, imagine you wake up one day and you go pick up the milk carton and you see your face as the missing kid face on the box. And now you're like, are these my parents? And I was like, dude, that's a great idea. Mm-hmm. And you did end up writing that script, didn't you?
Unfortunately, I did write that script.
I want to get into this story because it's a good lesson for budding screenwriters, people who want to get in the industry.
Oh, that fucking movie.
This movie became a movie called Abduction.
I 2011. Remember seeing previews for that.
Taylor Lautner.
Yeah.
Fucking.
I've seen it.
Twilight motherfucker.
Okay.
I actually watched it because Sean wrote it. So
yes, and watched. Screenplay written by
as
Sean.
As much Christian? As I hate Taylor Lautner, I watched that movie for you, Sean.
You have screenplay. Yeah.
You were the one.
Was that who you envisioned as the lead, Taylor Lautner?
No.
So where's the lesson in this? Let's get into this. What happened here?
First of all, you got to back up. I had been selling scripts for a couple of years at that point on just a very small sale, a couple small sales, spec sales, because I had become friends with a couple people in the industry, and I was able to get, the script to the guy, to the girl, to the guy, to the guy, to the girl, and then...
Like boom, full movie back. Scripts. These are full movie scripts.
Full movie scripts.
Nice.
And I had stumbled upon a couple, I was making money that way, I guess, and then I wrote... Abduction, and it was a disaster from the day that I...
Was that even the title, the original title of the thing?
The original title was the original title. There were these guys, these two producing entities, and they had this idea, and I wrote it while I was on tour, and it was really fun. It was a fun Hitchcock-inspired sort of... it was in the spirit of North by Northwest, I guess you would have maybe at the time you might have thought of that movie Disturbia as a framework for what it could have been. It was for teenager starring in North by Northwest sort of thing. And then I went through this this bidding war, and which sounds great, but really what was happening behind the scenes was the people who were interested in the script. Most of them were interested in a Taylor Lautner vehicle. I didn't attach them to the script. At that point, I preferred to just sell the screenplays on my own without anyone attached.
Right.
The producers wanted to attach him because this was his big...
Twilight was hot and shit, right?
Yes.
They were trying to transition him to like an action star?
Yeah, they were. He was really, for this 15 minutes in town, everybody in town sort of has, He was red hot at this moment. So I preferred just sell the screenplay like I had the other couple. And anyway, some people were looking at it as a Taylor Lautner vehicle. Some people looked at it as we want the script and not Taylor Lautner.
Fucking terrible.
But I couldn't entertain those offers. My agents couldn't entertain those offers because once he was on it, he was on it.
Yeah,
And he's a really sweet kid. And he... was young at the time. He was, I don't know what he was, 17, 18 years old. And, we went with Lionsgate because they promised, all but promised to make the movie. When I hadn't had anything made at that point, I sold a couple screenplays that went nowhere.
Oh.
And so they promised to make the movie. We went with them. And the day that I sold it, I got on the phone with the executives and I knew it was going to be, a pretty bad experience from that day forward.
But you think that when they attached John Singleton.
Yeah, that's what I was meant next.
The director of Boys in the Hood.
Oh, shit, it's John Singleton. Yeah.
Unbelievable.
I wasn't even around at that point. I left the, they did all. Yeah. I never even met John Singleton. So when you kind of look.
So it was already fucked from before John Singleton then. You're saying.
The executives at the studio were rewriting it. Some of them themselves.
Oh. So it's already being changed.
Does the original scriptwriter usually talk to the director? Is there usually a working relationship between them two? Or because you mentioned never even meeting him.
You would hope that the screenwriter sometimes, it depends on the kind of movie. Some scripts, they don't meet the director when there's 11 guys involved, 11 screenwriters and all that. Most situations, the main screenwriter who's, responsible for the best script of the movie and the director are together, and that's how the good movie happens.
Sure, okay. That's what I met John Singleton
for 2 minutes in a hallway. And that's it ever.
Wow.
And so like when you see, the posters came out a year and a half later.
Yeah.
And there's my name and there's John Singleton.
Yeah.
We never met.
So the thing is,
go ahead.
The suits pretty much hijacked this thing, basically.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Wow. And every cliche possible, which is why I don't talk about it much, because it's really so cliche.
That he can't even believe that this actually happens.
I can't even believe it. You know?
That's the thing. See, like, I go in and I hear, oh, Sean Christensen directed this movie. So, of course, I'm going to watch it because, you know, I know Sean and I know that he's smart and I know that he writes fucking good shit. Like, I just know it because I know the character of this person. So I go into the movie and I could see that there's a great movie in there somewhere. I do. I can see it. I can see it. But I don't know. I don't know how much got changed around or whatever. I mean, the idea is sound, though. The idea, the concept is there.
The concept was kind of there. Actually, the concept wasn't even there. I only saw it once. And it was at the premiere. And I didn't want to go.
Said, where was the premiere, Sean? L.A.?
The premiere, I think it was at the Man's Chinese Theater.
Oh, wow.
You know.
You're like, fuck that place.
When I was watching I just thought, this is not Sean Christensen.
Well, how much of the final movie kept your stuff, and how much did they change?
Basically, the final movie keeps the character names and the setup, the general setup of the story. All the dialogue is different. All of the whole second half is completely different. They literally erased the last 50 pages and turned. They took out all the plot twists. I'd say probably there's maybe at best 8 or 9% of my script.
Holy shit,
dude! They Josh Tranked his ass. That's all they did. Yeah. They went in afterwards and redid the whole movie, kicked them out, be like, okay, you don't get to see it. Here's
different.
The movie.
Josh Trank didn't write it, right?
The thing, though,
yeah.
That it was yeah. good that abduction happened, because otherwise it would never have led to, like, the shit that he fucking got awards for.
Yeah, so let's talk about the positive stuff. Now, you had this experience. Of course, you're going to learn. You're going to take notes. And did this sour you on writing, trying to get a movie made?
Yeah.
What was your
–
what?
Yeah, I was done.
Really?
I was done. I left L.A. At that point, I came back to New York, and I was, first of all, I was done with, you know, I was so, you know, I mean, you know, unlike you, I know when I'm depressed, which is.
That's a good skill.
Has no idea.
It's a good skill.
You have good self-awareness.
I have no self-awareness. So the
no,
depression is just chronic, you know, I just went back to New York and, you know, kind of just like kind of wanted to hide in a corner, and I just started making my own little short films because, you know, I didn't know if every time I sold a screenplay, it had to be rewritten, you know, which is that's the lay of the land, by the way. That's how it is. And it's there's a lot to be now that I'm in the business a little more, you know, there's a lot to be said for the rewriting. But at the time, I just felt that every time you know, I bring a script to somebody, it's got to be rewritten. Is there something? Am I not a good writer?
Right.
You know.
Right.
And, yeah.
The movie had come out, and I didn't. I didn't know what the plot was anymore, or what the MacGuffin was. I didn't know anything, and I had to go answer the press. That was actually probably the lowest.
Oh, weird.
Wow, you had to do press junket for abduction?
I had to do a press junket, and I literally did not know the plot of the movie.
You're all goddamn
right. I did not know the plot twist.
And the press has got to be looking at you sideways like, wait, you wrote this shit.
It was so... I had to call up my manager the night before, and I said, because it was right after the premiere, and I said, hey, man, I don't know what the fuck this movie is about. Like, I literally
like,
don't
can you
know
tell me how it ends? Because I
what
no
tell
idea.
Me what the t- what's awkward. Happening in this movie? Because like
wow,
these you know the press are going to ask me these questions, and I'm not going to know the answers to them. And it's kind of like almost like if you're, it's like if you you know. It's like going on the pitching mound for the seventh inning, you know, of a game and pretending you're a pitcher for those three outs, you know,
right.
Like it was kind of like that.
Wow.
Like pretending you could throw 90 miles per hour and that you were actually a part of this whole thing when reality was I sold it a year and a half earlier and I never heard from them again.
You know? Jesus.
That's unbelievable.
To quote True Romance, you're an actor, act motherfucker.
Yeah. But like that's the thing. I mean, like the guy spends all this time writing this thing. He fucking writes it and he's writing it to be good. He's not writing it to be fucking shitty.
Yeah.
He's writing the, he's laboring over it, and then he hands it over to some guy, and they're like, they change everything.
Well, what,
that would fucking annoy the fuck out of me.
What's the lesson here?
I would want to start beating people mercilessly.
Is the lesson not to be married to your work, or is the lesson you fight your battles and your integrity for a story you believe in?
I don't know if you even have the power to do that.
Well, you don't have the power when you're a lowly screenwriter.
So you can't be married to the shit. You just set it out there and forget about it. Okay, cash the paycheck. I'm moving on to the next fucking one.
But yeah, for me, it was just I don't know what the lesson was. There were a few lessons there. I think that for me, the lesson was that I don't know if it was a lesson really, but it was just a, you know, I'm not gonna just blindly sell away my work, my right. Yeah, yeah. The thing that I didn't really realize at that point in time is that good material is hard to come across in Hollywood. You know, I don't know how to explain it, but you sort of assume that there's all kinds of great scripts out there, but and there are, but finding them and kind of nurturing them and rewriting them to a place where they're really good, that's the thing that people don't see. They don't see where a screenplay can go. And so I realized, you know, that I had to control my work a little more at that stage and not just sell a spec blindly, unless it was going to be like I knew the director and I trust the director, I knew the people involved, specifically the executives and the producers and that sort of thing, then I'll sell it. You know,
I see a natural transition. I don't know if you have more.
No,
but I was thinking maybe the lesson here is then you end up writing your own script and directing it and
do
having
it yourself.
Full control, the do-it-yourself thing. Which
that will get us
to
– did you do Brink next then?
Yeah, well, I was doing Brink at the same time as all this went down.
Oh, okay.
So fill me in on Brink.
Brink was a
– tell me about Brink.
A little – it's just a short film. I guess it was sort of my second short film.
Okay.
That, and most people think it's my first because it's the only one I allowed anyone to see. You know, the first one was a good exercise called Walter King. But Brink was a sci-fi romance, I guess you call it. And it really had minimal dialogue and it had CG in it. It was like a very ambitious project, but it was just me and six other guys shot it, really, essentially. You know, there's a lot of people involved for, you know, here and there, but never was there more than six or seven people at the same time on set. And it was just it had Justin Chatwin in it.
Mm-hmm. From Shameless, a lot of Shameless connections coming up. He is in Shameless.
Yeah, he is, and Allison Huntington Chase, who she never had done anything at that point, but she was great for this role. It was just the two of them, and I made that, and I was encouraged by that. And then I went and did Curfew after that.
There we go.
So, listener, I'll put a link. So Brink is on Vimeo. You can watch it. I'll put a link in the show notes. Definitely check it out. It's a great short. I love the sound design in this movie. Like, it really makes it ratchets it up the tension and sucks you in. And I love the sci-fi angle. And I just wanted to know, how'd you make the things float, really?
Oh, the chick is hot, by the way.
Yeah, the chick is hot, too. She's beautiful. She is gorgeous. She's
gorgeous.
Yeah.
But
should we tell them what it's about real quick?
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Basically, this guy's writing a love story to his girl, and it's kind of an end of the world scenario. You see on the news that gravity is slowly being reversed or like being destroyed, mm-hmm. and stuff starts floating at different things.
Fuck me, let me watch this.
I put it in the show notes, motherfucker. See, the jock never checks the show notes.
Yeah, but you only told
exactly.
You have access to the show
you
notes.
You emphasized like three things.
But look at the show notes. That's why we have the show notes.
No,
we're like an old married couple.
The jock actually punches him right.
I will.
It's going to happen.
I will punch him one day.
He almost did before. We can watch it later. Listener, check it out. It's awesome. But how did you make the shit float real quick? That's what I wanted to know.
I watched behind the scenes of 2001, Space Odyssey. And I learned the tricks that Mr. Stanley used.
That's a good person to steal from.
In that movie. And then I, you know, at the end of it, I had to resort, obviously, to traditional, you know, we hired a CG place called Molecule, and we had some stuff done there, but there was a lot of in-camera illusions going on in that movie, and that was really fun, and that stuff really, you know, that really was an eye-opener for me, because that stuff really, really sells, in a way that CG couldn't for me.
It looks,
I just want to point out an Easter egg, though.
Yeah.
All right, now when... you see this movie, you're going to see this little teddy bear float in the air.
Oh, the teddy bear Easter egg, yes.
This teddy bear appears in other Sean Christensen films.
Yes, it does.
If you watch Before I Disappear, she's holding the teddy bear. And Curfew, she's holding that teddy bear.
It's like Sam Raimi's car, dude. You've created, you got your own Sam Raimi's car, which is awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. It's in all the movies, and it's going to be in another one I shoot in a month now. Another short film.
How did that come about? That's what I want to know.
Yeah. What is this bear? Where did this bear come from?
The bear.
Why can't it be me?
Why can't it be me? That's a good point.
They're holding
Why doesn't the girl have a scuzzy boy? Homeless puppet as a little thing?
Right. Why isn't Rug Boy in all the movies?
It's hard to explain. A teddy bear.
Very, very hard to answer that question. intelligently. The bear is from Japan. I bought it in Japan.
Oh, wow.
And I was going to give it to somebody as a... This I've never told this story, so I was going to give it to somebody who will remain nameless as a birthday gift. And before I gave it to them, I found out that they were talking behind my back saying very hurtful things. And so I decided to not give them this bear.
Nice.
On the birthday.
Did you give them a fuck you bear instead? Did you have another bear?
No, I didn't do anything. I made a very kind of one of those, you know, you wake up one day and you're like, these are my friends and these are not my friends.
Definitely unfriended on Facebook.
The bear represents, I guess, for lack of a better word, it represents positivity.
Yeah.
In a way, it represents a turn that I took to consciously just surround myself with people who are more positive, who are more excited, who are more passionate, who are more, you know, and just sort of, you know, kind of grow with these group of people who I can, you know, trust more. And the bear kind of represents a sort of a new chapter. So it'll be in all my films.
You didn't waste it on somebody that didn't deserve it.
No, it's actually right. And it's actually, you know, this next short film I'm going to do, I might as well plug it real quick. But
yeah, fuck yeah.
It's really the funny thing that you mentioned the bear is that the literally the setup of this short film is about these parents who live in a cul-de-sac, a stay-at-home dad and his wife live in a cul-de-sac, and they with their little boy, their 2-year-old son, and they discover a wiretap, a bug inside the teddy bear. And the short film just unfolds from there.
Wow!
But so this next film, the bear will be actually sort of.
That's a good hook,
dude. All your shit, dude, has amazing hooks at the beginning.
Well, the short films, you got to do it because the attention span for a short film actually is shorter than the attention span for a feature, believe it or not.
Oh, because you expect you're expecting a tighter experience.
Exactly. Huh. So, like, if you're going to sit in a theater and you know it's a 90-minute whatever thing, you're okay if it takes 20 minutes to get going,
right?
Because you're expecting that. But if you're on YouTube or you're on the web and it says little number down there says, you know, 9 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, I think the attitude is subconsciously or not, the attitude is this shit better get going quick.
Right.
Yeah, like the stuff's going to happen. Yeah. I mean, it's similar to music. Like, you want the first 30 seconds to grab a listener. Exactly. I challenge anyone to watch the beginning of Curfew Before I Disappear and not want to watch the rest of it.
That's where I was going to jump in is you made me – so I watched Before I Disappear before Curfew.
Right.
So I watched it in reverse. But I was like, damn, Imran's making me watch this fucking stupid-ass movie. Why the hell do I have to watch this shit?
Yeah.
But literally, like, when he's in the tub, and this is the same thing for Curfew as it is for Before I Disappear, so it's relevant to both, and he's sitting there in the red water, and he's, like, killing himself, and then the phone rings, and whatever happens, and he goes, okay, I'm gonna do this. I was like, all right, I'm in. That's a good hook.
Dude. That's an amazing.
This guy was literally about to kill himself, and now he's got some obligation that he has to take care of.
Dude, let's just get into Curfew, because I have so many questions. I need to know the story. Mm-hmm. This is
the Academy Award
short
winner.
Film. You can find it on iTunes. I will put it in the show notes. It is the Academy Award winner 2013 Best Live Action Short by Sean Christensen. Where did this idea come from for this movie?
massive depression where else everything else comes from.
You know? That, yeah, just, and that's interesting. Because,
now, where does your depression come from? Before we get into the movie, like, what do you like? You say you're depressed all the time.
Well,
but
let me just tell you.
I look at you and I think that you're like this great, like, you know, like happy guy. Oh. So. But you're not? Like, what do you
no,
mean?
No, come on.
He's not happy.
No, like, your talent has been validated in many ways.
Curfew is a story. Curfew is a story of, so I was in a, you know, whatever, what can I tell you? You know, depression isn't a thing that you can define, really. You know, it's sort of something that's just part of your makeup. It's part of your fabric. And it can, you know, once in a while you can identify, well, this is a thing that,
like extreme pessimism, maybe?
Well, that's yes.
Is that genetic?
Okay, I can understand that.
Of course, that's, you know. But I think for me, curfew was just, first of all, I was accused from Brink. I was accused, because there's not a lot of dialogue there. This producer was like, you know, I'd love to have you direct this other thing, and I can't. But no one knows if you can really, you know, have actors talk to each other. Yeah. You know, and I was like, what, are you kidding me? Like, what do you mean? Like, film a reverse? Like, have people in a diner having a conversation? I can't film that. It's
fucking
ridiculous.
Two-shot, that's easy. Yeah.
So I was – that's why I started thinking about making a movie that was like a standard every day. You know, here's this thing, and people talk to each other. And that was what Curfew.
Oh, so you wanted to showcase – it was kind of showcase for you.
Well, part of it had to be a calling card. I'm certainly – let me tell you right now, I'm certainly not out there to win an Oscar.
Yeah.
I'm out there to – I'm out there thinking that nobody gives a fuck about anything that I do, or and that's fine, but I just had to like find out if my writing was, you know, worthy. And I had this little idea of a story, and there were a lot of people who worked on Curfew who it was the first time that they were doing what they were doing on it. You know, the DP had only done a couple little films, and he did a fantastic job. Daniel Katz, a lot of people were just like friends who were all of us hungry and passionate and trying to find a good project to do. And we just put this, I put this script together, and I just wanted to, I wanted some hope. So it had to be hopeful ultimately.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so, and it also had to have a little bit of, humor in it, a little bit of levity. Otherwise it just, it would never have gone anywhere. And long before we were, you know, we got the accolades and all that, long before that, I, you know, there was a time when I had edited the movie and I literally didn't know if anyone was going to accept it into a festival, if anyone was going to watch it, if anyone cared, because you don't know. You don't know when you make things, when you make music or when you make films. You literally have no idea what to expect. So that's where it all starts, you know.
Wow, I have an insight into this. Is that there was a time where I actually showed up to the set of Curfew.
Oh, really?
Just to watch Sean do his thing.
Rugboy snuck on the set.
This motherfucker is directing a movie. I want to see this shit.
Oh shit, Rugs.
And okay. I walked in, and he had this camera, like whole getup set up, you know, this whole like camera rig going. He had the monitors going, and I just looked in the monitor, and just the minute I looked into the monitor and saw like David Fincher lighting,
yeah,
and like fucking like good shit happening, like this is fucking the Red camera at its best, you know, whatever. I'm like, he fucking framed his shit perfectly. He was like doing, I'm like, I knew it was going to be good. Like, I knew it was going to be good. And I only saw like maybe 3 seconds of footage, all right, from what he had shot. I knew it, like, moment in time.
That's crazy, too, because when I watched it as a casual, you know, not knowing anything, and I saw the David Fincher lighting, too, I was like, this movie is going to be depressing as fuck.
It gave you the
both
tone. Yeah.
And but then the comedy is what got, like, I was like, I legitimately laughed a few times. I was like, "This, what the hell? Like, this caught me off guard. This movie and this short.
It's
like,
darkly comic. It has everything that's in life. You have your serious moments, your comedic moments, your really dark moments.
Sean, that short is perfect.
The short is 19 minutes. Listener, I highly recommend. Here's what you don't understand for the listener. Let me just explain. This dude wrote the movie, directed the movie, starred in the movie. The man put everything together. You have no idea how hard it is. Not only that, he did a song, original song for the movie.
I did all those things. You know, that's like overcompensation to the max, right?
Yeah, that's great.
Know, it's like, you know, but I'll say this. You know, I financed that movie because of Abduction. I was able to use the money
to
make these little films because of these, you know, I really thought I was just some sort of sellout or something, but I had to use the money for something, you know, I couldn't just like squander it.
And that takes balls, dude.
You know, so it's expensive to make a short film if you want to make it well. You know, you can't just do it. I mean, listen, some people make a short film. I'm sure they make it for like $3,000 and, you know, it's amazing. I don't have that kind of talent. I need like a, you know, a proper budget. Mm-hmm. But, you know.
Well, I mean, Ron, I hinted at the what the setup was, but if you wanted to, just for anyone that hasn't seen Before I Disappear or Curfew.
I think we should give him like a little synopsis. Basically, you meet this character, Richie. And honestly, I love Richie. I would love to see another movie about Richie. Like, I want to know more about Richie. And it starts out, the man is committing suicide. And the phone rings, and he has to take care of his niece. And that's all.
That's all it is.
That's all I want to tell you, because it's an amazing turn of events. It is hopeful. It's so charming. Fatima, how do you say your last name?
Fatima Patachik.
Patachik. Fatima Patachik, the voice of Dora the Explorer. She is unbelievable in this movie. It has like two of my favorite scenes are the bowling alley scene, of course, and the shut the fuck up scene. I love so much. And then you added the menopausal medicine scene was another great
gag.
That
was hilarious.
And Before I Disappear. But I know there's a story behind that song, Sophia So Far, it's called?
Sophia So Far.
I love that song. It's a song that it's in the bowling alley.
Sophia, yeah. She's amazing.
She's so good.
You had her in both Curfew and Before I Disappear.
Well, I wasn't going to make the feature unless Fatima was.
Got it.
That
was one of my questions. Is you got her to do both?
She's incredible and really just was truthfully just you just never worry about her. You know, one of those rare actors. You just don't have to worry about, you know, you got to worry about, you know, a light is going to fall on someone's head or something, but you don't have to worry about. You know, because sometimes you do have to worry about the kids in movies.
Yeah.
Because it's hard to get them to you know, but not her.
I want to get into Before I Disappear.
Okay, but for Curfew, that song was awesome.
Oh, yeah, okay.
But what was the deal with that song? You kind of had to make that last minute, didn't you?
Here's the deal with the song. The band we wanted would not give us their song, would not give us it to literally just to license it for festivals. For whatever reason, I don't know what the reason was, but we couldn't get them to license it. And finally, they wanted to license the song. They let us have a festival fee. So for people who don't know what that is, that essentially means you can have the song for a year, a two-year window, simply for the festival circuit. You don't own the song or the rights to the song. And they wouldn't – the price they wanted for that was literally more than the entire rest of the budget of the music festival fees for the rest of the movie.
Jeez.
Which we had, I mean, we had Vera Lynn, we had Edward Sharp, I mean, Alexander in there. We had some great songs. And finally, 2 days before we started shooting the film, they were like, we pass.
Oh, man.
And I was like, yeah, pass.
What?
I thought we were like negotiating. Yeah. I didn't know what was happening.
Yeah, what asshole doesn't want their song in a movie?
That's what I was going
to
say.
It was a short film, and literally, to be perfectly honest, you know, we just really, you know, you ask when it's a short film and it's a festival fee, the first thing you ask for is, can we have it for free?
Right? Yeah, right.
Yeah.
And some of them say yes because they want the exposure, and some of them say no. Some of them say, yeah, for $50 or something, or 100 or a couple hundred. They wanted, I don't know what they wanted, but it was a lot. And so, I didn't know what to do, and I had already written the scene into the script and everything. And essentially, what we ended up doing was we played that their song for all the extras. Because for people who don't know the film, basically 60 extras have to dance in rhythm to the song.
Right.
or, you know, not dance, but be rhythmically.
They got to be on the beat at least.
They got to be on the beat.
Yeah.
And so we played that song for them on the set. with the idea that I would write a song in that tempo, find a song in that tempo.
Oh shit!
Later on, and which at the time felt like a good solve. Okay.
Yeah.
Until we finished the film, it's in the can, and I realized, oh my God, I have to write a song that a little 9-year-old girl would jump up and dance to in the middle of a bowling alley. Yeah. Now, look, I've written songs before, good and bad, but I've never had to write a song that was like kind of poppy enough for that a kid would dance to.
This was outside of your songwriting wheelhouse a little bit.
So for 4 weeks,
good challenge.
I built a track to that tempo. Also, by the way, I had to get that other song out of my head.
Yeah. Because
I had played it 100 times and I timed the scene to it and the whole thing. If you watch Curfew, the song in the bowling alley is only about a minute. The scene's only a minute. And that is literally how long the song exists.
So that song's a minute long.
It's only a minute.
Same thing before I disappear then too?
No, by the time I shot the feature, I wisened up a little and I completed the song. But for the short film, there's no middle or end or lyrics.
There's no lyrics.
Yeah, I noticed
there's
that.
No lyrics, yeah. There's just that. Me mumbling.
He's singing, but there's no lyrics.
Because you're just focused on what's going on.
No, he's singing noises.
No, I know. That's what I'm saying. You don't notice that.
Yeah.
You don't notice that the words make absolutely no sense.
Yeah, it's like a Pearl Jam song. Whatever. Eddie Vedder does that every time. Who cares?
Yeah.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
Tell me what he's saying in Yellow Ledbetter. I challenge anyone to tell me the lyrics to that fucking song.
Yes.
Rug
Boy might know.
All the lyrics to all the songs.
Okay, so.
The ones with mumbling.
Before I disappear.
Yeah. Wait, but you missed the whole thing.
What am I missing?
What the fuck was it like getting an Oscar from fucking, who was it? I had it written down here. Jamie Foxx and Kerry Washington presented him with a goddamn Oscar.
Jamie Foxx.
Holy Kerry shit, Washington. Dude.
Jamie Foxx lost the envelope.
What? He lost it?
He lost the envelope.
No shit.
And I think he was jealous he didn't win.
I didn't know. I don't know. You go up on the stage, you have no idea what's happening. It's literally like this mini blackout.
Yeah,
do you
remember any of that?
This was televised?
I'm sitting there watching the Academy Awards.
It's like you drink a lot, you go to Jersey, you don't remember, and then you come back. You wake up the next day in New York City. It was kind of like that. You don't know what happened. But you go up on stage, and then 5 minutes later, you're holding this this little.
Did you have any inkling at all that you were that you were gonna get it at the time?
No, because the movie is not your. I don't know how to explain it, but it's not a.
It's not what those people typically give Oscars to.
You kind of feel like you feel like it's not a political movie. Yes. It's not a topical. It's not a social commentary type of movie. It's sort of, it's a little bit, it had more humor in it, I would guess, dark, very dark humor, but more humor than the other films, which were very serious and very well executed. It was a really tough, all the nominees were so good that it was a real question mark as to what was going to happen. Now, my wish was to not win it.
Really?
Yes, because I don't want to go on that stage. I don't want to go up there in front of people or anything. I was happy just to be here. To be here. So it's not that I didn't want to win it. I didn't really didn't want to go. I really was, happy enough. Listen, when you're nominated for an Academy Award, what else do you? You don't really need to win it.
That's true.
It's great. Yeah. It's just an honor. And I didn't need any more than that. Certainly didn't need the aggravation of being humiliated on national television.
It was great, dude. So that moment you're sitting there, the nominees are being read.
Yeah.
It's right before they announce the winner. What the hell is going through your head, dude? And when they said your name, then what happened?
Well, they say... I don't remember. I think maybe it was just which way towards the stage.
You know, so you're sitting down. You have to come down.
Very simple. Honestly, it's something very, you know, make sure that you walk the right direction kind of thing, you know, or that you, if they call your name, I mean, you just honestly, you don't know what to do. They sit there, they say it, and they said, they didn't say my name, I don't think. They said the name of the...
Oh, the movie, yeah.
The movie. So they said curfew, and, you know, you get up, and, you know, I remember I kissed my wife. I hugged Jan England, who made a fantastic film called Henry, and went up to the stage. And then, you know, you just make sure you thank all the people who were involved. I didn't have any.
A thing prepared?
No, I didn't. I had a. I didn't think I was going to win, yeah. So I went over there with nothing. And Damon, my producer, was like, you know, you ought to think of something. And I said, well, look, you know, we're not going to win it. So what difference does it fucking make? I'm not going to. And he said, just, you know, you should have something. And I said, let me do this. I'll write down to make sure the people who I need to thank.
Yeah. Just
so that was it. That's all I had.
So
anything else would be presumptuous.
Yeah.
So you get the Oscar, right? And then you have to do the whole thing. You go to the parties, whatever. And then what happens afterwards? Like now you have the Oscar, and now you're sitting there thinking, like, what the fuck? Like, what do I do now?
And are people blowing you up, or, like, what's going on?
And where is the Oscar?
Yeah, your Twitter must have been fucking your phone must have been, like, shit in a brick at that point.
Where is the Oscar? Can we see it?
Can you
see
it? You're
such a dick writer.
Can you stick it in my Slack hole?
Oscar Slack hole. No, we don't need to see it. I'm just saying, we had an Emmy sitting on this table. We had an Emmy here. We had an Emmy-winning photographer on the show. And, mm-hmm. and this halfway completes our EGOT. I just need a person who's
a Grammy.
Won a Grammy and a Tony, and we'll have an EGOT.
Yeah, you guys will have it all. Yeah. This is.
Yeah, no, what happens next after the Oscar?
Wait, what's the EGOT again? It's the Emmy,
Grammy,
Oscar, Tony.
Tony.
Usually, though, if you think about it, it's composers are going to get that shit.
Right.
Because they're the only ones that would do.
But there are people who have all of them. Must be like Barbara Streisand type.
Yeah. Yeah. Singers and musicians, have the best shot at getting the EGOTs.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Right. Well, I'm not looking for any of that.
You do it all a little bit. I think you can get an EGOT.
I'll stop at Ego.
Ruggs has got the
Ego. I don't need the Tony.
Ego. That's a lot of work, you know.
You got to shuffle around. It's all day long.
Two shows on Sundays? Go fuck yourself.
Killed Michael Keaton in Birdman.
Yeah.
I want to fucking do that shit.
Yeah. A lot of work goes into that one. Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
So after the Oscar, you get this thing. Are you blowing up? What's your next? What are you like?
Are people blowing you up for gigs? Like, what's going on?
You don't really blow up when you're in the short film category. You know, that's usually the bathroom break category. When people kind of, you know, I mean, I myself, being a fan, watch the Oscars. I definitely have gone to get the chips, the crackers, you know, during some of those littler categories, you know. So that was the one thing that kept me going, was I knew no one would be watching if I went up there on the stage, you know. It was just really the narrative changed. It was like, oh, he's not a hack screenwriter. Maybe he can do something. That was the change in narrative, I guess. You know, it was more like, oh, well, he can direct, you know, maybe. I don't know. We'll see. You know, so that's kind of where the conversations kind of went. So I sort of got looped back into the film industry. But it was on a different level. You meet different people. You're in different rooms, you know, more like-minded people, I guess, instead of like, you know, those sort of cliche, you know, dark, shadowy executives that you hear about, you know. You kind of know who they are and who they aren't. This is some executives at the studios are so good. You know, they're so good at what they do. And you just got to like kind of filter out which human being is the really good one and with creative notes and which one isn't, you know.
So how long does it take you to go from doing Curfew to doing Before I Disappear? Is that like the first project on the slate, or is that like something else and then you kind of like, oh no, I should do this instead?
That was just, you know, we had some friends of ours who had money and not a lot of it, but they said, let's go make the feature version. And we had a script that we were kind of honing in on a feature-length version, and we went and made it fairly quickly. I mean, we just went and made it, and you know, I can't say that. Anyway, so we expanded on the short film, yeah. I guess you
could say. Yeah, for the listener, Before I Disappear is a feature version of Curfew. It came out in 2014. I'll put a link in the show notes. You can go rent this movie, buy it. It's on demand.
It's not on Netflix, though,
is it? Is it on Netflix?
No, it is.
Oh, it is. It is on Netflix. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Just watch it today. It's there.
Right on.
The only way people know about it is it's on Netflix, I think.
Sean, when you make Before I Disappear, is it intimidating or daunting to now you have to expand upon a short film that won an Oscar? So now the expectations are higher.
Yeah, almost. I guess so. I couldn't really look at it that way. But what was daunting to me was I shot Curfew since it was on my own dime, and since this is a short film and it's not a union thing really, it's sort of just a little thing. I was able to shoot 2 pages a day, which is a very good pace to shoot a film at. The feature, if I remember correctly, was about 6 pages a day. And when you're shooting 6 pages a day and you're starring in it, you're basically a real jerk. You know, I mean, you really just can't do that. You can't function. I really was making a mistake in a way, shooting at that pace, you know. And so I guess, you know, it was a tough one to – honestly, it was a tough one to film.
Wow. It's reshot beautifully. Like, what the stuff you reshot from Curfew is – it's amazing. Like, going back to the same locations was great. There were points where I was like, is this the same footage? Did he reshoot this? It was done so seamlessly.
It was very seamless.
So basically, listener, in this movie, we find out more about Richie. Richie gets his whole backstory, and there's some side plots. How much of this backstory did you have already, like, in your head during Curfew, maybe?
None,
really?
Oh, wow. That's crazy.
In Curfew, it was really just the mystery, in a weird way, was what kept me going. You know, it was not knowing. It was kind of knowing the guy, you know, knowing the mix of people who, you know, I knew in real life, kind of mixing a couple key figures who I knew together, and I knew who they were, I knew their backgrounds, and I knew what they were into, but I didn't have like a back story for Curfew, because obviously it's a very present day situation. You kind of get the idea that if the guy is, you know, obviously trying to off himself, he's got some baggage,
sure. Skeletons, people chasing him.
Yeah.
Debts, maybe?
Grim Reaper.
Yeah. I love it.
Some debts. Well, that stuff, the Grim Reaper stuff, was fun to put in, and it was fun to do some of those things. And I think people like you, you know, when you say you watch the feature first, I find people who watch the feature before the short film are overwhelmingly more positive about the movie for whatever reason, maybe because they haven't seen my bag of tricks yet, or for whatever reason. You know.
Here's a good critique. I know this lady who was a real kind of choosy about everything.
She doesn't like anything, basically.
Yeah, nope. And I recommended your movie to this person, and there was a glowing review. So you won somebody, like the Ice Queen, over, basically.
Well, and Anthony also just watched this movie out of the blue.
Before I Disappear, I liked it. Yeah. I just, that's all I'd seen was that first.
Yeah.
So the way you were able to seamlessly add a backstory that you didn't already have in mind when you first made Curfew, I thought it all connected very well, actually. I didn't think it demythologized Richie at all. I thought it was all made sense to me.
I think if you take it on its own as its own movie, and if there was no short film that existed for you, it, for whatever reason, you know, it works really well. I can't see that though, because I'm not objective about the whole thing. You know, I don't know what I don't know what's what after I was making those movies. It's like kind of a blur. Yeah, and we're trying to repeat the scenes too. You're trying to repeat the magic. Yeah, it's a whole.
I mean, the fact that you had to redo those scenes and still they were so good both times. That's what I love about both movies is the sense of like wonder and kind of fantasy and hallucination. Like you're not sure if he's hallucinating or if he's just that fucked up on drugs that he's seeing these things. I love when a movie does that, and you pull that off really well with those scenes.
I think you know, a lot of indie movies, you know, they I just wanted to just be a little bit more bold, you know. I just wanted to just try some things, and if they didn't work, they didn't work. If they did work, they did work. I think Before Disappear for me was just let me try out some things that aren't exactly, you know, the normal route, and play a little bit, you know. And it wasn't the investors were really kind to give me the money to do it, and so we went right into that. And I think there's some good stuff in there, you know.
So the first thing you notice, listener, if you watch both movies, is Fatima is a little bit older in Before I Disappear, where, you know, she's still at this great age, great performance. What? How was that? Was that challenging? Were you able to use? Did you have to rewrite stuff? Were you able to use the same stuff? Was you sensitive to the age difference with this character?
I had to rewrite some of her stuff because she had grown up. She was 12.
So what line doesn't work when you're 12? That when you're 8?
Taller. She was growing all over the place, and I didn't want there to be any, you know, thing, any, you know, connotations. I just wanted it to be, I wanted it to be still. She's the little niece, the lovable niece. So, but I had to, the difference is that when she's a 9-year-old, she's like completely oblivious, you know, to Richie's plight. And then when in the feature, clearly at that age, you can't be that.
Yeah, she's realizing shit's going on.
She has to know. So that was where I had to sort of rewrite.
Wow.
And actually,
I thought it
was in a way better for her as a character. Her arc was better because she doesn't have as big an arc in the short film. The feature, her arc is better, especially when she's kind of having to sort of save him and she has to go into the pharmacy.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember I mentioned that to you, Imran?
Great.
I thought her arc worked better in the full
length feature
film.
Yeah, she had more to do.
My favorite scene in the whole movie, that I have a lot of favorite scenes in that movie, but both movies. But one of my favorite things is that Sean or Richie is like, he's dying, right? He's got like the open wound and Fatima has, and she has to go run and go to the thing.
Yeah.
And she comes back and she tells him that somebody told her that she was an abortion that should have been had. And he just gets up like Hulk Hogan, you know, like remember the Hulkster when he would like and get back up with like all that like vigor? He got up and he went to go kick that guy's ass.
That's great, dude.
I love that.
It was so
That's
great.
One of my favorite parts of the movie.
And then to end that with like kind of a comedic fight, slap fight scene.
Well, that's
like Richie can't do anything right.
That's Fran Kranz, who is a phenomenal.
He was on Dollhouse. I used to like.
Oh.
He's phenomenal. A phenomenal actor and friend, and I called him in for the afternoon. I said, "Would you want to come in and we'll just have an awkward fight?" And,
it's very awkward.
And he did it, you know. He did the cameo.
You mentioned Fran Kranz, and now we're name dropping. How does you go about getting Emily Rossum and then Ron Perlman?
Dude,
geek moment.
Fucking Hellboy, dude.
Hellboy.
How'd you get
there? He's more than Hellboy. He's
I know.
Awesome.
I got to credit Paul Wesley for sort of a lot of that casting. You know, he had the same agent as Emmy. Emmy and I and Paul were in acting classes in New York earlier on, and I didn't really know her much from then, but she came in and did the table read, I guess you'd say, and she made a comment. She said, "Oh, I wish I was 6 years older and I could play the role," you know. And so it got me thinking that I should. And I just loved her. I loved the chemistry that she had. She's just a great actress.
Oh, when she does that scene where you're talking to her,
oh my god,
as a brother and sister, and she starts to fucking feel like the loss of you being in her life.
She's
and
amazing.
Realizing
that was, she sold it so well.
She's great. That's
I almost started tearing up.
Listen, and let's like, not get – we have to give credit to Sean. Like, you keep joking you're a shitty actor. You guys, Sean is an only child, right? And you play off this brother-sister thing amazingly.
Because I don't think I played amazingly, but I think that I wanted a sister growing up for whatever reason. Yeah. And Emmy just really – I mean, what can I say? She's just – I mean, she's a professional. She's phenomenal. And she was – so I wrote the role. I rewrote the role for her that she got knocked up in high school.
Which was amazing.
So that she could play that role. Yeah. She could sell it. And actually, it makes her role more a little more richer as a result of it. You know?
Now, I have another question for Sean. Is that how did you get inspiration for Richie? That's one of the things that – I always wonder about, and I think I've asked you this before, but I want you to get on.
Anthony thought you talk like that normally.
No, because we all know that Sean talks like a normal person.
Yeah. He's definitely a combination of a handful of guys that I know, and these are guys that I know that have tougher lives, tougher backgrounds, it's tougher for them to, you know, I don't know, be in social situations. And I kind of just combined these guys because they're sort of the people, for whatever reason, I like the misfits, and I like the people who are a little bit the underdogs, and those are my favorite people who a lot of my friends and so
I like that he's a New York character, though. He's got that New York accent. He's got the New York mentality.
Yeah, he's very and so these guys, a lot of these guys have that going on, and
it's a great New York movie. You shot New York so lovingly. It looks awesome. It reminds me of like why I wanted to go to New York when I was a kid. Like that was the New York I always wanted to go to, this scuzzy, dark, danky New York.
I was going to say, I have an observation real quick about Emily Rossum, her character, and I don't know if this was the intent, but what I really like about her is it seems like in the beginning she's this character that has her shit together and is like living a good life, like really like on top of her game. And then slowly during the film, you see the seams start to come loose on her character, and that she has a ton of skeletons as well. And she's not all that much better than Richie, even though Richie's about to kill himself. You know, she doesn't have her shit completely together either. And you notice that at the end, she has just as many skeletons almost as Richie, but she has to turn back to family to kind of get her life back in order. And so does Richie.
Well, yeah, it's not that she has as many skeletons, but it's that they come from the same place, you know, and she ignores where she came from. Yeah. She wants to get as far away from where she came from as possible.
He's a reminder of that.
They're kind of the same person. They're closer than she wants to admit to herself.
That blonde chick was like a red hair. I was like, is she – like I didn't know what she was. I was like, is she an assassin? Like, because at this point in this movie, you're like – it's so hyper-reality that I'm just like – is she an assassin? Is he imagining this? What's going on?
I love how it hints into like – it reminded me of Go a lot. Doug Liman's Go. It kind of dips into like a crime drama kind of thing, which is great. What was it like working across from Perlman in that table scene? That circle shot was amazing, first of all.
First of all, the reason for the circle shot was because I was so exhausted at that point that I was too lazy to stand up.
So
I was like, what can we do here, you know? And basically, Ron and I just decided we're just going to sit down for the whole fucking scene. The camera guys can do all the work.
Yeah, that's great.
So for people who haven't seen the movie or people who have seen the movie, basically at that moment in time, you're there and you're having you're there with your niece, and she's having dinner. She helps herself to some food.
Yeah.
And then you automatically slide back into the night before. Is that what we're looking at there, or is that something else?
Oh, yeah. What happens there? How?
You also insist on greens for your niece. She has to have greens.
Yeah, you put those greens on.
Yeah, that's also great.
That's ridiculous because I don't eat the vegetables in real life. Yeah, that's probably the best bit of acting.
He has actually Richie's diet.
Is that what happens? Yeah. I mean, that's what happens. You slide right back into last night, or is that like, or are you constructing an alternate
reality?
Was
Richie there when that shit went down?
Yeah, I think Richie's there the night before, and he's just kind of, you know, he's ignoring This is another thing about the guys that I base Richie on, is that what they do is they have these blinders, you know, and they don't want to, like, you know, stuff just happens in front of them or around them, and they don't want to admit or acknowledge that it's going on, and it's just, it is what it is, and you know what, yeah, that's how the person treats my sister or treats my whoever, and I just ignore it, you know. And I think for that point in the movie, it was just like, this is what really happened the night before. Wow. And he knows it, and they both know it. And they just kind of get down to the bottom of it, you know.
I have one critique on your movie.
Okay, great.
Oh, are you ready to hear this? Can you hear
me? Hold on.
Here's the rundown. All right.
A preemptive.
Strap yourself in, Sean.
Okay. Strap yourself in, fucks.
All right. When there's a scene where you, like, are smoking a cigarette and you look at some guy polishing a bowling ball.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yes.
Now
he sure is polishing it.
Okay. The thing is, you've established this drug in this movie called Flora. Yeah. Why isn't Flora in that moment?
That is Flora, dude. Flora is just another word,
like,
for
why
heroin.
Isn't that packaging, that same, like, Chinese letter packaging there? Like, I would. Here's
what I think. I think he hallucinated that. I don't think that actually happened. Because
heroin. Every time you refer to heroin, it's those white packets that Ron Perlman gives them.
Yeah, yeah.
I would love to have seen that there.
Oh, but that's just the kind of heroin
that's his brand.
That guy deals. Yeah. You know, there's all different kinds. I mean, Richie's an addict. You know, it's not like he necessarily only has one sort of thing.
You could never buy that guy as a heroin dealer, by the way.
Yeah, I don't think I would not buy heroin from that dude.
I'll never have cast him in the
that
movie.
That dude is clearly a narc, dude. Come on.
He looked like a cop.
Yeah, no.
He was just one mustache short of being
a cop. I'm talking about the guy polishing the bowling ball. That was clearly a narc that should not be trusted. I would never buy shit off
him. He was touching the shit out of that ball.
Stroking that ball quite lovingly.
He did look like a very suspect fellow.
Very deviant. I don't know.
Yeah.
A deviant, yes.
So, finally, let's not forget to mention that Sean has framed this whole story with letters to a girl named Vista.
Yes.
Let's talk about where did this part of this come into?
Is it because you really didn't like Windows Vista?
he's an XP fan.
On the Windows operating
system. Oh, he's a Mac guy. Fuck Windows Vista.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't
it's
really
such a
yeah,
shitty thing. It has guy.
Although the Surface is kind of cool.
What was cool?
The Microsoft Surface. Never mind. Don't get me geeking out about fucking things.
In the future,
no one's going to remember that operating system.
No.
Hopefully.
Yeah.
But the letters, I don't know where the letters came from. I think I was, I thought it might be interesting if there was this letter that the guy had to keep rewriting this. He just really couldn't really word the suicide note correctly.
Yeah.
And then
it works as a narrative element too.
Sort of morphs into the fact that he's really not writing a suicide note at all.
Yeah.
You know, he's just kind of writing a love letter. And that's just part of my dark, sort of weird sense of humor, I suppose. I don't really know where that comes from, but I thought it was a nice, as you said, framing device.
I love it. I love the dark parts. It's definitely your style, dude. She seemed like she was kind of like a spiritual guide in a way, where she almost represented life and death at different times. Like, you know, I'm coming to be with you, but really. And I love that line where he figures out what to write to her as closure at the end.
Yeah.
Stuff like that.
Yeah, she's a... she's, you know, there's a mystery there. I think, you know, in the short film, there's a lot of mystery going on in a way, because you don't know really these two characters' background.
Yeah.
And so for the feature, the question becomes, how do you kind of like make the movie, you expand it, you find those, whatever you want to call it, those menopause scenes or the David Bowie scenes or whatever those scenes are. You kind of expand it and try to find scenes that are going to work, but you also kind of, sustain, you know, the mystery of their backgrounds. And so that was also part of that, too, was to still feel like you don't know everything.
Well, let's figure out the mystery. Is Vista dead, or is she someone that left him, or is that ambiguous on purpose, as Imran?
I mean, you know.
Did she overdose? Was that her Vista's end?
Because he hints at her leaving, but then he also hints at when...
I'm not going to comment on that.
Okay.
I'm not going to comment on anything about what her background is, except for to say that I don't think that she's still around anymore.
Okay. She's like his little guy. No, it's so good. Listener, definitely check out Curfew. Check out Before I Disappear. Check out Brink. Check out Stella Star. I will have all these links right there.
It's Jock approved, which is a big thing.
It's also
Rugboy approved.
And it's Rugboy approved. So all these awesome links of all Sean's awesome stuff will be right there in the show notes. It's right there in your iPod app right there. And check out jockandnerd.com for the show notes.
The Jock and Nerd Podcast.
By the way, I just read that Ron Perlman rumored for the role of Swamp Thing
in
Guillermo del Toro's Justice League Dark.
That'd be cool.
Which would be
really,
I want to see Justice League Dark.
He'd be like Hellboy and Swamp Thing.
That's great. Those are some great comic book credits for Perlman, man. So you were talking about what's your next thing? What's that called?
Well, piggyback on that question. Since what is your next thing? You also write, you direct, you act. Is there anything that you're particularly going to focus on or that you want to do? So what is your next thing?
I'll focus on
all of them.
I'll focus on the directing.
Directing,
because
okay.
No one's really – the only person who's ever cast me in a movie is me. You know? So it's not like, you know, people are jumping around casting me.
You're really good. This is why we got along initially, because I'm the same way. I wanted to do everything.
Right.
I love drawing. I love playing music. I love performing. I love doing like radio. I wanted to make movies. I wanted to be in movies. I did stand up for a second a couple of years ago. And that's why I understand it's just all creative outlet, you know, and you go wherever the creative muse takes you.
Will you continue directing? Will you continue to cast yourself in movies you direct?
I don't know. It depends. Probably in a smaller role or capacity, I might think about it. I'll do a script next year called Sydney Hall, which will probably be completely devoid of me in front of the camera. I don't know. I kind of, like I said, I like to sort of dabble in each of the things, and it's kind of go by wherever the wind takes me. Right now, I have no interest in being in front of the camera.
I think you should have the first movie that stars a puppet.
Yeah. What would the puppet be named?
I don't know.
Does anybody know of a Felty that needs work?
His name is Arby.
That's possibly homeless and needs sandwiches to be sent to him.
It writes itself.
You know, speaking of directing, I've directed Sean twice, people.
That's right.
Do you remember, Sean?
Those was one of them. You directed me. Was one of the things a black and white thing or no?
We acted
together in some things.
Yeah, we acted together in a lot of other student films. But remember we did Zoo Story, Edward Albee's amazing.
Not a film. But yeah.
And there was also a video for my video class. Remember the Amish doll video with that girl that made no sense? And then also we put on at Pratt.
What the fuck are we talking about?
So at Pratt they put on a student run plays. There was this whole thing, and there's this amazing play. It's called Zoo Story by Edward Albee. If you ever see this, listener, you guys go see any performance of this. It's a half an hour, one act play. There's two characters. They meet in the park, Central Park, and in half an hour, both of these characters' lives are fucking changed forever. It's amazing. And the reason I did this in college is because we did this in high school, and I tried out for it, and I didn't get it, and I was like, "Fuck you guys, I'm gonna do it myself." And it was me and Sean, two characters, and I kind of directed him, and he did most of the heavy lifting. He had pages and pages of monologues. Like, it was pretty much all you talking and telling stories.
Remember? There's definitely like a 6 or 7 page monologue in that play.
Yes, all him.
Yeah. That's fucking impossible. Yeah.
But I remember the second performance, like, we had a girl crying in the front row. You remember that?
Oh, we were I remember that was a really good
actually it was very impressive, actually.
Because there was another play that we were piggybacking off of, if I remember right. Yes. The Boy's Life or something.
Yes, we were in that one too. That's right.
I think it was a two play because, you know, the plays weren't long enough to justify. Yes. So it was like Zoo Story and this other play. I don't know what the other – I don't remember.
I don't remember the other one either.
The Deuce story is, you know, I've seen it and I've been, you know, in an acting class and seen studies and stuff. Deuce story is a popular one to do
it's
a
so
bit
good.
From that. It's a really – he's a phenomenal writer. Also did another play, I think, maybe called The Goat or something.
Yeah.
I mean, you gotta check it out. It's really wacky. He's really a phenomenal writer.
Yeah, I think Edward Albee will write. I'll watch that play.
Yeah.
I got a couple of questions for Sean if we have time
it.
For it.
Do it.
All right. Number one, it's a two-parter, Shawnee.
Oh, boy.
Okay. So
yeah.
Number one, what do you geek out about? What are you into?
Yes,
like,
do you
watch TV shows? What kind of shows do you watch? Are you into, like, do you have a guilty pleasure? And then number two, take us through a day in the life of Sean Christensen. Like, what's that like?
The second question is really the most boring answer on the face.
No, what do you do? Like, yeah, no, I want to know.
But the first, so let's see, what do I, what, the first one is what?
What are you geeking out about now? Because on the Jock and Nerd podcast, we geek out about shit all the time.
Right.
So it's only appropriate we ask you that.
I'm going to wholeheartedly admit that I am one of the last people to the Game of Thrones.
No, I still haven't watched it.
Oh, me neither.
You haven't? Oh, you guys haven't
No.
seen
it? No, I love it, by
okay.
the way.
Rug Boy's in.
Only the Jock and Nerd have not, Rug Boy has.
I did the 50-episode binge recently.
Wow!
Yes.
Oh boy!
You got Khaleesi'd.
Like, yes.
How did that go?
Yeah. Did you? Was it
oh,
good?
Oh man!
It that is that good. Is,
it's a whole other level of television writing that show right there. But neither of you guys have seen
no,
it.
No, I have not. I know I should watch
I
it.
I don't know why.
I'm surprised from the.
I know.
I'm surprised from the. Yeah.
We're bad nerds. We're bad nerds over
maybe,
here.
But not from the.
No, I'm a bad.
Stop. Just tits. Just watch.
Actually, I'll tell you, yeah.
That's all it is. That's what I heard.
The show is, in a weird way, the show is kind of for everyone.
If you're a pervert, there's something.
I mean, there's something for everybody.
I think what's holding – and I can speak for Imran on this. I think it's just time. There's so much media to consume.
I have no fucking time to watch. And I know it's amazing, and we're very bad nerds for not having watched any Game of Thrones. I understand that. We'll catch up at some point.
I thought I was the last in the party.
No,
it's not.
Only Imran.
No, only me and Anthony.
That's it.
The last two fucking losers.
Anything else, Sean? Anything else that you're geeking out about? Anything else that you've caught on to that's like just completely caught your attention?
There's a story that I'm geeking out on a little bit that somebody told me about. And this might Anthony, you know, I don't know if you've ever heard of Jerry Tarkanian before.
Oh yeah, the UNLV head coach.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a you know, I'm interested in his story.
What's his story?
I don't have a lot of knowledge about college basketball outside of, you know, March Madness and all that stuff. But this guy. Really, he was a father figure to a lot of the guys in the team, but essentially he gets sort of fired from Long Beach and then he goes and retreats to the desert, to the, you know, sort of the Frank Sinatra of Vegas in the early 70s, and he starts this team, you know, UNLV, and it's one of those, you know, sort of scrappy teams that goes against adversity, you know, and kind of starts changing the way we look at college basketball.
So are you interested in maybe adapting this?
I'll make a 30 for 30.
I'm interested in the story of it, yeah, a little bit maybe.
He built
up
UNLV to be, they were at one time in the early 90s a program that was undefeated and favored to win it all, and they got upset.
Yeah.
Like, they were like a star stack team.
Because of him. Whoa.
Yeah.
I got a sidebar to this, by the way.
Yeah.
Now, I know that you're a Mets fan.
I was going to bring this up.
Now, were you at any of the games? Like, how excited were you? I mean, you're probably blowing your load on this.
Anthony is a Cubs fan.
By the way, I'm a Cubs fan. Thank you.
Hey, listen, the Cubs, there's nothing to – the Cubs are – you can't root against the Cubs. You know, I mean, I don't care who you are as a baseball fan. So it's very hard when the Mets play the Cubs. You know, it's very hard. You know, I root for the home team, but the Cubs, you got to love the Cubs. You got to, like, understand their plight.
Yeah.
You know? But by the way, both teams, Mets and the Cubs, they're both of those teams are future. You know, their future is ahead of them. You know, they're,
right.
they're just beginning.
They were both a year ahead of schedule in my opinion.
I think they both were a year ahead of schedule. So to see them there at that point was kind of crazy, you know. It's crazy to see them there. And also the Astros, to see those three teams in those final stages. But the Mets, you know.
Did you go to the games?
We tried to go to a game and we got scammed.
What? Oh, what?
Oh,
you got bad tickets?
We stupidly did a Craigslist thing.
Yeah, Craigslist.
We,
not the best.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. I feel my balls.
So what did they give you? It looked like tickets? What'd you get? Like, did they look like tickets?
We got nothing. We made the transaction, or a friend of it was four of us. One of the guys made the transaction and the tickets never arrived, and it was just a complete scam, man. We completely got...
You
gotta
stick to StubHub or something.
Shit, that sucks.
StubHub or like a major league resale market.
We never got to that game, and that
was that guy's. Give me that guy's email address. I'll have.
We tried to do all the.
Can I ask
the Rugby Mafia after?
Can I just ask a stupid question? Because I stopped paying attention after the Cubs were knocked out. Who ended up winning?
Kansas. Wow, you're an idiot. Kansas City.
Yeah, it was the Mets did lose. Okay.
How about the Royals?
How do you?
The Royals took it in five. I think.
Yeah, five games.
It was kind of weird. Because you thought that the Mets were having a chance and they came back to like New York and you're like, all right, they're gonna fucking rally now. Now they're gonna fucking put the nail in the coffin, and it didn't happen.
Well, the Royals ended up like coming back a few times. The Mets had them on the ropes in a few games.
There was a time where the Mets were about to win.
Yeah. There were two
games that went into extra innings, if I recall.
Yep.
And the thing with the Mets is we had this guy on our team, Daniel Murphy, who is, you know, normally just sort of, you know, your everyday average player. There's nothing, but he was so phenomenal in the playoffs. The problem is that the Mets won the playoffs, and I apologize to the Chicago fans listening, but the Mets won the playoffs so early because it was basically a shutout.
Yep.
They won so early that there was going to be about 6 days of days off before the World Series.
It's a long time in baseball, isn't it?
Daniel Murphy was done. You know, he's not going to keep it up 6 days from now.
This guy, Imran, was playing out of his mind. And this guy was like an okay player during the league. Right. But he was playing – he hit six straight games of home runs.
Whoa.
Yeah,
like it was a record. He broke records. But then he started playing like he normally does in the World Series, which is just okay. I mean, he's not the greatest fielder. He made a huge error. Cespedes, and Familia all played below how they normally play.
So they just lost momentum in that little break there.
Because baseball is a game of momentum.
I have a more important question.
Yeah.
Okay, Shoney boy, did you have any money on these games?
Oh.
I did not.
Because Sean likes to live dangerously.
I did not have any money on
Not one? I don't believe it for a second, dude.
Let me just tell you, if you are a Mets fan, you never bet on the Mets.
Gotcha.
That's like sealing the deal right there.
Yeah,
write that down, listener. That's good advice.
Mets fan, you know, you just...
I respect that.
You kind of ride the seat and you hope for the best.
Okay.
You know, you don't bet on them because you don't jinx. You know, there's a lifetime of rejection involved. I can't say there's been as much as the Cubs.
I was going to say a lifetime? We've went through two lifetimes.
100
four generations.
Over 100. And can I tell you, Sean, I was so afraid if they won at home. I was like, we're going to find out what 107 years of suppressed celebration is going to look like. And they're going to burn this fucking town down. I was literally ready to board up my windows and go into the basement with my shotgun and be ready.
I really think for the Cubs, it's going to happen. I mean, they got mad.
What's going to happen for first, though? The Mets or the Cubs, Johnny?
Ooh, good question.
See, I really have to be a realist with the Mets, you know, and with the Cubs, I can be non-realistic because they're not my team. I don't care if I jinx them or not. So the thing with the Cubs is I do believe that they are going to, they're going to take the whole thing very soon within the next 5 years is my
guess.
Very political. I don't know about the Mets.
Objectively, you want to have.
I hope the Mets do, but I can't say that they for sure will. But I really feel like the Cubs have a very good chance of doing that.
Objectively, you would say the Mets have what you want in this playoffs, which is great young starting pitching, power arms.
Yeah.
The Cubs have great young hitting. The only thing that the longevity is for the Cubs is a little better just because pitching tends to get a lot more hurt than hitting ever does. The hitters usually stay a lot healthier, usually, than pitchers. Pitchers blow out their arms all the time.
Well, so, you're not supposed to repeatedly do that to your arm over and over again.
You're
that's
not supposed
just
to repeatedly throw a ball 95 miles
an hour. No, we're not.
I heard about that. Jacking off, too. Like, you're supposed to do that a lot, too. That's long, I still do it.
Yeah, but
never more than five times a day.
And you got to alternate hands to even it out.
Both teams will be good, though, next year.
They'll both be good.
Yeah.
That's the end of the story. Yeah,
they'll both be good, and they're both young.
All right, well, I think you know what? I'm going to play Sweeper. We'll give out the final plugs, and we'll wrap this shit up.
Sounds good.
Doc and Nerd.
Listener, check the show notes for all the cool stuff we talked about. Sean, man, thank you so much for coming on and hanging out and great stories. Listen, anytime you have something you want to promote, you come back here anytime you want. We'd love to have you on again. This has been so much fun. Catching up, can you tell the listener where they can maybe find you if they want to say hi or check out your stuff?
They can find me on the world wide web.
Whoa, what's that?
It's this thing that happened.
Are you
not going to last?
Are you big on
his Twitter screen name is that the Cubs suck.
Search at the Cubs suck, and
you'll find Sean Christensen.
Are you big on the Twitters though, buddy? How do you like? Do you like to interact with the fans or and whatnot? What's your?
I go on there sometimes. I'm learning how to do it. I'm a little introverted, so it's tough for me. I don't really, but I'll get, if somebody interacts with me, I might interact back.
Do you have psycho fans?
I feel like we're having like if you interact with me,
But do you have psycho fans though?
I don't think.
Do you ever have like a stalker fan?
I mean,
that made you uncomfortable.
There's a couple over the years that were a little bit like, all right, this person needs to be blocked.
Oh boy,
a couple of those.
Wow, but, really?
Like, when I
think I know who they are.
I think I mean two. not a lot.
Oh, that's not that bad. Rug Boy is one of them. Unblock Rug Boy.
Yeah,
Rug Boy.
You can follow Rug Boy at Really Rug Boy on Twitter. Rugboy's killing.
Can follow me at Really Rugboy on Twitter. That's the only thing I have. The only way of communicating.
He has more followers than we do, than the Jock and Nerd podcast Twitter. He's killing it.
He's on there.
I'm very famous.
Sean, you want to give out your Twitter? Or are you good with that?
Just Dreamsick, DREAMSICK.
At Dreamsick. I will put that link in the show notes. And, this has been so awesome, listener. I hope you check out all this stuff. Check out Curfew Before I Disappear, Stellstar, all of it, man. Let us know what you
Thanks
think.
A lot.
Yeah. Listen, you got Imran here. You should do a guest reunion. That's what I say.
Oh, boy. Well, there is the post show. So, let's wrap up this main part and see what happens. You guys, listener, if you're listening and you had a comment, you wanted to chime into the conversation, it's very easy. We have something called a SpeakPipe. Just visit speakpipe.com/jockandnerd or click the little link in the show notes right there. You can leave a 90-second message and we'll play it on the show.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. You can also just go old-fashioned and email us at show@jockandnerd.com. We also have a Twitter, Jock and Nerd Cast, although Rugboy has more followers than us. Facebook.com/jockandnerd. And we're on Clamor, and we do live shows on this thing called The Blab.
Sean, you got to check out one of our Blab shows. You saw the video, but we do it live, and people watch us and comment.
No, I checked out a couple.
Oh my God. It's the most. Rugboy is blowing up on the Blabs and the webcam. He is going to take over the internet very soon. And so just go to jockandnerd.com/live. You can see all our live replays, schedule, subscribe to the next one. As always, please subscribe in iTunes. Rate us, review us. It helps. You'll get the show free right in your pocket, and it helps us get found. Just go to jockandnerd.com.
It definitely helps the show a lot.
/review.
More than you would think.
Everything is there. Jockandnerd.com for all the links. All right, fellas. Thanks for hanging out. My name is Imran.
My name's Anthony.
He's the Jock.
He's the Nerd.
We'll hear you next time. So... I wanted to do one thing. I wanted to get a little bit. There's something I wanted to get a little bit personal with Sean there, buddy. Here's the deal. Here's the deal. I played the song Jenny for Anthony.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
Right before this, I was like, yeah, just listen to the words of the song, and then I asked him, "Well, what do you think the song is about?" And what did you say?
I felt like it was some sort of, this Jenny person was some sort of demon chasing after you or whoever was singing, or you were singing about this demon named Jenny or some spirit coming after someone.
Yep.
So, buddy, I, for years,
I know where this is going.
For years, I just wanted to hear out of you, from your own words, about the origin of this song.
The origin of the song. The origin of the song.
I'm putting him on the spot here. This is great.
So I
think, no one's ever asked him this, by the way.
No, this has been asked, I think.
Really?
I think it's been asked before. Well, not in this way.
I want you to be honest.
Not in this direct way.
The origin of the song is that so first of all,
he can't lie about it, right?
I can't lie about it.
No, he doesn't.
I don't. Everything's blunt honesty with me anyway.
You don't lie. You're like Richie.
And people, by the way, are blunt honest with me. So,
but you're just like Richie. You don't lie.
I don't lie.
At one point in time, I was in a place called the Pantis Lounge.
Yes.
All right. Now, Pantis. I think it's called Pantis, right?
Yeah,
am I right about that?
Yeah. Pantis, it's one of the dorms.
Was a dormitory.
Yeah.
And there was this girl in the lounge, and she was literally talking to herself.
He's just saying the lyrics now.
No, but she was literally talking to herself. And this is years ago. And then a friend of mine, and I thought this girl was like, I was like, okay, this girl's clearly not all there, you know. And a friend of mine fell for this girl, fell in love with this girl.
What a douchebag.
And
shit.
And he fell in love with this girl. And then it kind of, it put a little bit of a wedge between not only myself and him, but him and some other people as well. This girl, you know, it's the cliche story of the girl, you know, it's the, what are you, with the John Lennon and the
Yoko,
yes.
It's the Yoko story a little bit. And so, anyways, fast forward a few years later, and, you know, I'm writing songs. Some of the lyrics are bullshit. Some of them are about personal things. I'm running out of material. And then I started thinking about this friendship I had and this girl who came in and kind of named Jenny or Jennifer, I guess, Jen. And so I wrote a song about it.
So when I heard this song, finally, somebody turned me on to this song. And I played the song. And the range of emotions that I felt, here's why, to you, Anthony, and to the listener, that was me. Jennifer was my first girlfriend.
I have a question already following up after you're done.
So she was the first girl, like, ever girlfriend. And I was a late bloomer. So, like, you know, I'm in college. I've never had a girlfriend. I'd never even kissed a girl, really. Mm-hmm. And we were in this band, and we were very close. And finally, the first time this girl is, like, into me. And you know how you lose yourself in a person sometimes? I was kind of a dick. I was kind of an ass, and I kind of lost myself into her because I didn't – this was a whole new experience. And that led into a different crowd and more first experiences, which kind of – you get with a girl and you don't see your buddy anymore.
Right.
And I knew this for years before the song came out. I felt so bad about this for a long time because I knew what I did to these guys. Basically, he's talking about Rugboy and Sean, both of them. And then I heard this song. And, dude, you have no idea. The first time I heard the song, like, what I felt. Like, I felt I was sorry.
Now did you know, were you introduced to the song through someone else, and they told you, hey, there's this song that, or did you, how did you know? What was your?
I think somebody told me, hey, there is this song about Jennifer. And I was
it wasn't me, by the way.
It wasn't you, Ruggs?
No.
I don't remember who it was. And I didn't even know you guys.
Because I had called you and you had already known about this.
Who the fuck told me?
So what makes you?
Maybe. I don't know who told me, but.
What makes you date a chick that the first impression is her talking to herself by herself?
No, that wasn't his impression.
Oh, that was yours.
What about Jose?
That was just
maybe. Oh, maybe it was Jose. It was Jose.
It was Jose.
I think he's the one.
That was just like, you know, me. Again, you know, another thing, too, as a sidebar is when you're writing, when you've written 20, 25, 30 songs, you run out of.
But what you, wait, what you want to know what happened?
You can't say the same thing anymore, you know? So you start thinking about other personal things that have happened to you.
When I heard that, though, you get so much credibility from that, from me, anyway, writing about something that is actually true.
Yeah.
You know? And I was like. Well, I thought that was such a great thing. That was, you know what? I know that Jen, she's still somewhere in Brooklyn right now.
Yep.
And she's a nice girl, and she's was a bartender at the Back Fence for a very long time, and I've had many conversations with her.
Now, another thing that happened, let me just say, is that Imran brought her to a Stella Star show.
Yeah. Okay.
You brought her to a show.
Yeah.
Yeah, you don't remember this.
I did.
You brought her to a show.
Did you? She hates that song, first of all.
Does she know it's about her?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. She hates that fucking song.
So I got up the stage. I had no idea.
Well, because
I forgot.
There she fucking is. You know? Sometimes you write. Sometimes you write a song, you write something, and you're like, "Oh, well, this person is
never going to hear this
about them." Yeah. You know, or they're never going to hear it.
Listen, basically,
and then there she is.
I mean,
I can't blame her for being. I thought it was about a demon.
I mean, I don't remember all the lyrics. I'm sure they're exaggerated.
It wasn't that bad, you know what I mean?
No, it wasn't that.
It was exactly what you described. It's about a guy getting sucked up in a girl,
right?
And her like not letting go of that guy.
Look
like,
guys,
her, like staking her claim.
I took it as like temptation.
Overly pretentious here. I mean, sometimes you have to rhyme a word. You know? Exactly.
What else rhymes with Jenny? Listen, the reason I bring this up, because honestly, I wanted to tell you this for years, and both of you to some extent. That is one of my all-time songs, favorite songs in the world. It means so much to me. I felt even more connected with you. And you guys, officially, I'm sorry for the way that shit fucking went down, because I've always felt bad about it.
Listen, Imran, I'll tell you this right now, I'll tell this to you, and Sean, listen, us hanging out is always, no matter what, right now, even at this moment, I feel great.
Yes, yeah.
And I always feel great around your presence, so it doesn't even matter what you, if it's negative, positive, stupid, whatever, I'll take it, because it's better than being around regular people.
That's true. And, I mean, if we're going to get sappy, dude, you guys really were two, and still, you were my closest friends I've ever had at the time of my life that I changed so much, that, like, really informed me.
Just think about your life in a regular thing. People are fucking boring.
Yeah.
They suck.
Yeah.
They don't have anything interesting to say.
Yep.
And you're interesting, Imran. That's why we do this thing together, because you're fucking interesting.
Imran, you have a gigantic Spider-Man behind your fucking head. There's no doubt about it.
You don't even know what the story
go,
is.
Go.
Imran's very talented. Imran, now we have to talk about Imran for a second.
No,
we have to talk about Imran for a second here, because this guy – so – at one point in time, you were doing so many things at once, though.
Yeah,
this was actually where the song came from. Not the song, but in the first place, was that before you had met her, I think it was, you were running the Prattler, right?
Yeah.
Right? You were running it. I mean, you had a...
And the Static Fish.
Static Fish. And right? I worked at the AV fucking thing and ran the sound for every fucking thing they
you
did there.
You were doing all the extracurricular activities.
Was Buffalo's on a Roll still in this fall?
Extracurricular
absolutely.
Buffalo's on a Roll radio show. And, yes.
There was the radio show, the Prattler, there was the...
How did I ever go to class?
There was classes.
Fuck.
Yeah, how did you have time?
That's why you didn't graduate.
Yeah, I did.
The classes.
How did you have time to get laid? That's what I want to know.
Nobody cared about the classes.
In
know?
Between classes. That was.
There was a comic strip about vitiligo, about you. There was a whole very personal thing going on. So there was a lot of these things going on, you know, this wealth of imagination and talent.
There was the plays and the musicals, remember?
And then we were playing music. I forgot to mention.
And we were playing music and we were doing theater. Yeah.
right?
Shit.
And we were writing all this original material.
Yeah.
So I think part of my whole thing was, you know, was where did the, I guess I blamed foolishly, because you're a kid, when you're, you know, whatever, girls, you know, they really fuck shit up. So I blamed wrongfully so, but you know, you get hooked on people, and I blamed her a little bit for taking you out of the all these things that you were doing that were so beautiful, you know. So that was part of where that also came from as well, you know.
Yeah, it was a lot of new experiences for me all at once, and I did not know how to handle
it. It's a late puberty
that people do, you know.
Listen, I always consider that. That the fact that you guys were able to stay in contact all these years is fucking a feat of fucking strength right there.
I mean, if it hadn't
been... The fact that you guys still keep in contact after 20 years, there's something there. There's some kind of a real... There's a real respect for one another in a way. And, like, I don't even talk to people I went to high school with at all.
I don't talk
to
people.
Me neither.
I actually do not either.
Really?
I don't talk to anyone from high school. Barely.
Yeah.
No need to... You know, when you go to... Yeah. You know, college friends are different than high school.
Way different.
Friends, you know, you're really coming into your own in college. And a lot of things...
Into your own sock a lot.
Yeah. We know Rugboy's got one stiff sock back there. That's what I heard.
A lot of socks.
Use a black light.
Sometimes you don't use a sock.
You know? Sometimes you got to use like a plastic bag.
That's an interesting point, though.
Chinese takeout will do.
An interesting point you bring up, though, is between the difference between high school and friends and college friends. You're hopefully developing into a higher level of thinking.
Yeah.
You're becoming an adult.
But you're stuck with high school people. You don't choose those people.
That's right. A good point.
You choose like when you choose a college, you're choosing your destiny.
That's true.
High school, you don't choose. You just get stuck wherever you get stuck.
Well, I mean, I went to a big high school, so I chose shitty friends. I chose friends that looked all right. Like, that was it.
I think though, you know, when you're in high school, if you go to Pratt, which is in Brooklyn, anywhere, any end of the Columbia, NYU, School of Visual Arts, any of those things. Most of those people who are in all those colleges, they're from some suburban town or some fucking hobunk town somewhere in America that they're trying to get the fuck out of.
Yep.
You know, so you kind of go. So college a lot of times becomes a destination place, and it becomes where you have more like-minded individuals. High school is like, you're forced. It's, you know, you're forced to be there. You know, and you're usually in a town that no one's ever heard. I was from a town no one ever fucking heard of. Then you go to New York City. You don't want to go back to the town that no one ever heard of.
Yeah, absolutely.
You want to, you know, so it's your New York City friend. So, but I'd see him, Ron. You know, I'd see him.
If you hadn't come through Chicago, on your tours, and you played the Metro every time. That's when So it's been a couple of years, but
the other one was the Double Door.
They played the Double Door too, and.
I see Sean periodically, but like I haven't seen Emron in a while. I see him on more on the podcast than anything else.
But like, this is the most Rugboy and I have hung out.
I love Emron. I will love Emron till the day.
He's getting drunk again. See,
when's the last time Emron has been to the New York City metro area?
It's been a long time.
It's probably over 14-15 years. I need to make a trip. I think I came post. I came
It's like 8 years.
Oh, it was 8 years. Okay, that's still been a long time though.
So. Did I see you when you were in New York last time?
One time you did. Remember you came out? All you guys came out and I got really drunk really fast and I don't remember what happened.
Yeah. I think I was coming and you were going or something.
I was just smashed and Jose got me to his place and I have no recollection of it. All I remember is I went to see Jennifer working at the bar and she goes, how did you get drunk so fast?
That bar is not there anymore, by the way.
Back fence is gone?
Yeah, it's gone. That fucking place is gone.
Oh, yeah, So what's New York like now compared to back then? How's it different?
New York's still all right, you know. Like, there's still places you can go to have a good time. I like Brooklyn a lot more than New York City, but now
Sharky was telling me Brooklyn's getting pretty gentrified too.
Brooklyn is the place to be.
It is getting gentrified. I mean, it's getting like Williamsburg is like. We used to rehearse down by the bridge down South 4th Street in Williamsburg, which, you know, used to be kind of, you know, it's in Williamsburg, but it's not like the hip part of Williamsburg. I just went there a few weeks ago, and it is Yeah, I mean, it's like hip as fuck.
I well,
mean, it's
like, Before I Disappear was filmed at Brooklyn Bowl, which is in Williamsburg.
Brooklyn Bowl is off the beaten path.
And you shot both movies there, right? The same. It was the same.
Yeah. Because you know when you have that tight a budget, you know you need to go to a place that just. That where there's no production design needed.
It just looks great.
The camera on the
that head. Place was a genius choice.
It's a great space, and it's also, by the way, a nightclub / bowling alley / you know, it has Rock Band. The guy who owned the Wetlands. That guy runs the Rook and Bowl. Let us shoot there for pennies, essentially, but that's off of I'm trying to think where that is. There's another bowling alley there called Gutterball, which is literally just two lanes and a bar.
Now Sean knows this because he's a fucking expert bowler.
Are you a good bowler?
I tried to bowl with Sean once. No, Let me tell you this story.
I'm not an expert bowler.
I tried to bowl. See, now what happened was
you rolled with two hands the bowling ball.
All right,
it was a selfie roll.
So one of his friends saw me bowl once. Now, what happens is I don't bowl. I got like no bones in my arms. All right. I got no ability.
He's all floppy.
So it was just luck. I had bowled a turkey. All right. Which is like three strikes in a row. So this motherfucker tells Sean, I got a ringer for you at a bowling tournament. So Sean was like, yo, you got to be in this bowling tournament because we need a fucking ringer.
Oh, no.
Oh, yeah. That's right. Yeah.
So I show up. And I bowled the worst game ever. I pretty much was gutter bowling. Never got called back. I knew when they got invited that I was not going to bowl well.
Yeah, they screwed the pooch on that one.
Yeah. They're like, it's okay. I knew what I was doing.
Look at this puppet bowl.
I wouldn't invited myself back either. I was fucking gutter bowling.
What's your average? What's your average score there, Sean?
It's like 69. No.
It's a great score.
I'm not that great. I'm like a, you know, my average is like a 120. I'm not a great bowler. I'm just like good enough to like play in the leagues where you drink a lot and you bowl.
He's very competitive. He doesn't want to fuck around.
I'm competitive, but I don't win. I don't win that often.
He's also a good poker player, by the way.
I will admit I was going to be a poker player. When the whole abduction thing happened.
Glasses
and the hats.
If you look up Mud Files.
Yeah.
If you look up Mud Files on the poker sites, you can look up poker people's like stats and stuff.
Yeah.
And that was my online that was what I was going to do. I was literally going to become a poker player, but this thing called Black Friday happened. And Black Friday was when the government
shut it down.
U.S. government shut down PokerStars, Absolute Poker, and Full Tilt. And so all of our money
disappeared.
$200 million was locked. We didn't know.
Frozen.
Where is it?
Well, eventually the Department of Justice, like 4 years later, paid us.
Oh, wow. This is at the tail end of the whole Texas Hold'em craze where fucking 22-year-olds are showing up at these tournaments.
Interesting to interview right now.
Wow.
Yeah. So internet, that was what I was going to do. I was going to become a poker player.
Everybody was doing it. Oh, shit, dude. You must be good at Hold'em then.
I was having some success at it, and I was doing the math thing of it.
Oh, you were?
You were a law of averages guy?
I was a law of averages poker player.
Because I always thought the difference is in person, you're reading the person. But when you're doing this online, you have to change your strategy.
Yeah, and online the strategy became just, you know, it was just, it had to be the, you know, it was a certain kind of tournament, certain kind of buy-in, certain kind of when the blinds, amount of time when the blinds get changed. I was becoming a good player, but I was also just looking at the pragmatic situation was, well, if I play this many tournaments and I win this amount of 1 per 10 or per 12, you know, if I cash.
Yeah.
I will raise up, and in 6 months I made a really good. Wow. I was, you know, making that I could continue to do that, and then they shut us all down.
This blows my mind.
Yeah. Today, you know, There's no legal online poker in New York, essentially. No, so I'm kind of waiting.
Not anymore.
But in Jersey, they have it.
You could just always come by.
Yeah.
All right, listen, like, this blows my mind because I'm not good at anything. Like, I'm not good at poker. I'm not good at directing movies. I'm not good at being in a band. I'm not good at shit. I can barely be on this radio show.
And even then, he forgets character names and gets things mixed up.
Yeah, I can't even fucking review a show.
Remember when we had him review a show?
And review a show?
Yeah.
I don't know anybody's name on the show.
It's like
referring to them as like vague fucking descriptions. It's like the guy with the thing. Yeah. Remember that guy with the thing?
It's literally like, hey, Rug Boy, do the synopsis for us. And then I got to like take over. Imran's got to take over.
That's so good.
I think that you do that on purpose, Anthony. You know that I don't know what the fuck you're talking about.
Put him on the spot. It's great comedy.
Put me on the spot.
Hey, so did that online poker skill translate well when you're in a live situation?
It's no different. It's different.
It does nothing for you, does it?
No. Oh, shit. In live, I'd say in live, I've probably either lost money or broke even at best.
Oh, yeah. Shit. You're like, this is fucking.
But truth be told, I can't go to Atlantic. It's Atlantic City.
Yeah.
I can't go there more. I would go once every 3 months. You know, it's a trek.
Yeah.
And so I would go into the Borgata and I would play the when they came to the East Coast, the bigger tournaments, and I didn't win shit. You know,
I mean, there's an intimidation factor.
Every day, maybe I would, figure it out. But I was a good online poker.
Reading,
I
know a guy who does
live poker events, and he makes shitloads of money.
Wow.
If I lived next door to the Borgata, it would be bad news. Yeah.
You just need a week and you would figure
I'd
out.
I'd either be homeless in a ditch somewhere, or I'd be like,
gambling in New York State, though.
What was that?
So they're opening up gambling in New York State.
I think one of these days they'll make online available. But yeah, I don't know. That's it. That's all I have to say.
I did not know that. That's good. All right.
That's what I bring you to the show. Right
yeah.
Now.
Well done. All right, you guys.
I think it's this motherfucker.
All right.
I don't want to keep anybody any longer. But thank you so much,
guys. I love you guys. Love you both.
Love we'll you too, man.
Again,
thank you.
In the future, hopefully you edit together something worth listening.
Oh,
to.
Oh, it'll be great. Seriously, dude. Where do you keep the Oscar?
Oh yeah,
I keep it in this room.
Oh really?
So it's kind of—I don't know if you can see.
Oh, there it is. There it.
Holy shit!
There it is.
Where?
Right here.
Oh, there it is.
Yeah, cool.
You know, it's next to a pretentious typewriter.
The old school typewriter.
Old school typewriter.
I lost it for a couple weeks.
What?
And you missed? Yeah.
How do you what?
The Oscar or the typewriter?
I lost both of them. Well, no, I lost the Oscar for sure. Though I actually called up the Academy. And I was like, so what would happen?
Hypothetical question, guys.
Hypothetically, if I lost the trophy, and they were like, you didn't. I was like, no, I didn't. I have it. But
if I did lose it,
and they were like, you lost it. Like, here's what happened. It's not that I lost it. I haven't like really searched for it. I think I have it, but like it's been misplaced. And they admitted that they
have extras.
They make you a new one.
Oh wow!
But they make you a new one, but they track down the they're all numbered, so they track down the one, and if it ever appears anywhere,
do you know what your number is?
Yeah, the number on it is I don't remember it offhand, but I think it's
69.
That's 69.
Yeah, I forgot to mention.
It's like in the 3000s. I forgot how many that they've ever made.
They make
3,300 or something.
And they make them all in Chicago. I forgot to mention, like, one company makes, like, all the Emmys, all the Oscars, all those trophies. They're in Chicago, this company. And so I imagine just in the dumpster, there's a bunch of Oscars with typos on them. It says, like, Harrison Blord, and they got to throw it out. They're like, you fuck this one.
No, the Oscar comes without the name. So when you receive it, if you watch the show, if you watch carefully any of the Oscars, you'll see that the trophy doesn't have anything on the bottom of it. It's just like – it's like they give out 30 that night and it's just 30 trophies. Okay. Then later at the governor's ball, they put your nameplate on it.
Oh, nice. Cool. That's cool.
In front of you. They literally put you at a bar. They give you a fucking drink. And they like put your name on it.
That's
and they
awesome.
Say, is this correct, Mr. Christensen? And you're like, what the fuck do I care? Yeah. Oh, it looks great. It's an Oscar.
Give me the fucking thing.